Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! About Wednesday, y'all. We kind of broke with tradition, and I didn't get to tell the night before Thanksgiving story, and, well, gosh, it all just sucked. But the fact of the matter was, when the interweb tubes go out here, there ain't not just a heck of a lot going out there from here, that is. So my apologies, but we certainly do have plenty to go into and cuss and discuss about this evening now, don't we? Yeah, and then some. Before I forget, right off the bat, a humongous thank you goes out to Janie, who took care of 15 slots in the Thrifty 250 right before airtime today. Thank you very kindly. And with that, I can note to you that we need 60 more people to do $10 a piece between now and Wednesday night, and we will have taken care of November. We will get in under the wire. We will finish November in the black. So it would be wonderful if that could happen. That's 20 people a night. And this program note, speaking per night, tomorrow night is another one of those very special evenings. A gentle reminder that we will have a Dr. Bill American History Chat featuring Dr. Bill O'Brien and Professor Keith Lilly tomorrow night, beginning at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on the Horn. And I heartily encourage you all to attend and listen. Yes, this is a program that is geared toward people participating in the PRISM West Virginia American History program, and so there will be a little bit of housekeeping, maybe 15 minutes or so, something like that. But the vast majority of what you get is information, American history, that you will not hear anywhere else, and that I dare say you would be hard-pressed to go and find for yourself. Not that you couldn't, but it's just it's a matter of going and looking, and golly, there's a lot of stuff to look through. So that will be taking place tomorrow night at 7 p.m. I hope you'll join in. And then, of course, we will close out November on Wednesday the 30th. And we're just keeping our fingers crossed. It will be a little bit dodgy during the first half of this month. I have to be gone for some mountaintop removal activism-related business in the second and third weeks of the month. It will be... Well, it'll take me away from the microphone, and I hate that. But that's just it. That's how it is. As I've said before, I couldn't sit here and tell you about the horrors of what the coal industry are doing to Appalachia if all I was doing was sitting and talking about it. Because little recovering Southern Baptist that I am, I heard often growing up down there in the basement of the Baptist church where the little old blue-haired ladies tell you all the good stuff about religion and wait until you get upstairs for you to find out the tawdry, nasty business. Be ye hearers of the word and not doers, be ye doers of the word and not hearers only. See, it's been a while. Be ye doers of the word and not hearers only. And I have to be a doer. And I can't just sit here, and I guess you would modify that for my purposes and make it be ye doers of the word and not talkers only. So, yeah, I got to walk the walk if I'm going to talk the talk. So that's going to take me away from the microphone in the second and third weeks of December. But then we'll cruise right downhill to the end of the year with little or no interruption, hopefully. Okie dokie. Good. So that's where everything stands at this point. It is hard to believe. It's more in Monday again. It seems like we had barely finished one up, and then the just dealt with the leftovers on Tuesday, and here we are again. Of course, we had all the madness of Thanksgiving. I hope, and let me say now, I hope you all had a lovely Thanksgiving. I know some of you did not. I got a heartbreaking email from a listener apologizing for not contributing to keep things going here. Oi. Oi. And pointing out that this year they could not even afford a turkey at Thanksgiving. And it made my heart feel like it was made of sinking stone. But I hope that in being together, you were able to have a happy Thanksgiving. It was quite the jaunty mess around here. I will never be the kind of chef who has everything perfect and out on the table all at the same time. No, I think I would require a phalanx of stoves for something like that. But we had the turkey, which was perfect, and we had the dressing, of which I think there were about 50 pounds. You know, dressing is the ultimate poor people's food. It's made out of stale bread, easy-to-obtain seasonings, and broth or hot water, and maybe some celery and onion. And, you know, people do oysters and chestnuts and things like that. And we never stuff the bird. That's just nasty. But dressing, yeah. Cranberry sauce, mashed potatoes, sweet potato croquettes, the traditional household banana pudding for dessert. That's something I added just because the kids love it and my father did too. I hope you all had a joyous time together. It was nice to get a little bit of a break. It really was. On Friday, I watched my beloved Mountaineers play their last ever installment in the backyard brawl against hated rival Pitt. You know, we won't be renewing that rivalry that's been going on for 134 years and has been played 104 times. We won't be renewing that rivalry next year because it's more important for Pitt to go to the Atlantic Coast Conference and more important for WVU to be playing football against Texas Tech than it is for us to maintain historic traditions 134 years long or 117 or whatever. And the Mountaineers came out ahead. So now Cincinnati can win out. We can go to a BCS bowl that we don't deserve. It was a nice, relaxing time. Of course, in the midst of all the nice, relaxing times, well, what? Yeah. It's why we have more in Mondays, isn't it? Kinda is. Because, God, the Morans came out on Thanksgiving was barely over before the Morans came out. But I have to promote to the head of the class, even though there are other Morans almost equally deserving, I have to promote to the head of the class Damn it, where's that drum roll when I'm looking for it? Oh, well. Kansas governor and former United States Senator Sam Brownback.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, it's Moran Monday on the horn. Hurry, 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 step right up, for less than the cost of one thin dime per hour of programming, you too can tell the Morans. You can't tell them without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. You can always tell a Moran, but you just can't tell them much. Hurry, 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 step right up, waste no time. Women with small children are advised to stay on the outside of this thin cybernetic veil that stands between you and utter moranity. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Ladies, do not set your purse down around the morans. They are right-wingers, and what you won't give to them, they will happily take. Watch your wallets, gents. It's Moran Monday on the horn. We have big morans, little morans, Kansas morans. Morans o'plenty. We got the morans on Moran Monday. Head for the hills! Or you'll be up to your armpits in morans. No, really. Sam Brownback. Sam Brownback, who was speaking to the Kansas high school group called Youth in Government. I don't know, is that a little bit like Boys and Girls State? That's what we had when I was a teenager. Youth in Government. Oi. So, it turns out that last week, a lovely young teenager by the name of Emma Sullivan of East Shawnee Mission High School, Kansas, was at her Youth in Government meeting, and she tweeted to about 15 followers, or 20, or 50 followers, or whatever. She tweeted that Governor Brownback really sucked, and she used the hashtag, he blows a lot. Now, being paranoid repiglickens, Sam Brownback's staff scours the interweb tubes hourly to discover what's being said about Sam Brownback. Now, we all remember Sam Brownback, right? He's one of those religious fundamentalist weirdos who wants to cram his religion down the throats of everybody else on the planet. Yeah. Speaking of cramming religion down the throats of everyone on the planet, we passed a bit of a historical, anniversary, I guess? Yeah? We passed it just a couple of days ago. And I thought that, it's worth mentioning in light of Sam Brownback. Because, it's kind of like the same thing. Sam Brownback's staff found out that young Emma Sullivan had tweeted that Governor Brownback sucks and used the hashtag, he blows a lot. And the staff immediately got on the phone to tattle. Isn't that just gross? Isn't that so junior high? Governor Brownback tattled on a 17-year-old little girl to her high school principal, who then ordered her to write a one-page letter of apology to Governor Brownback and suggested some talking points for her. Well, this morning, Emma Sullivan tweeted the following. I've decided not to write the letter, but I hope this opens the door for average citizens to voice their opinion and to be heard. It's 2011. In a minute, the relevance of the date will become obvious. It's 2011. And there are still people in the United States and in the governor's mansion of the state of Kansas who think that there is something wrong with a teenager saying, my governor sucks. I mean, Jesus, I'm a 48-year-old man. I live in West Virginia, and I can say with absolutely 100% guaranteed take-it-to-the-bank certainty that my governor sucks. And the governor before him sucked. And the governor before him sucked. They blows a lot.
But, of course, nobody's tried to compel me to write a letter of apology. But because authority loves to shove around those it deems to be weaker than them, they thought they would shove around young Miss Emma Sullivan, who had like 15, 20, 50 Twitter followers before this all broke, and as of this morning had something approaching 10,000. Stupid, stupid, stupid Repiglickens. Don't... Hey, Repiglickens. See that little pile of dew over on the ground? Now, I'm going to give you a sharp stick, and you figure out what you ought to do with it. Now, your average stupid, knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing Repiglicken will immediately go and start stirring the pile. Woo-wee, don't that stink? When the smart money is on leaving it lay there and letting it dry up and not smell so much. But no. No, they... That was disrespectful to the governor, Mrs. Excellencies. Governor LePetitmaine, how are you this morning? Hello, boys. Did you miss me? Work, 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 work. Yeah. Well, guess who lost that battle? This is just simply nothing short of absolutely delightful. Guess who apologized? Yeah. The Repiglicken with fascist tendencies. You know, the guy who wants to control every woman's insides. Sam Brownback. But Sam Brownback's not enough man to simply apologize on his own right and say, buck stops here. Well, you know, Harry Truman was from Kansas City, and that's on the east side of that whole Kansas-Missouri line, and he said the buck stops here, which apparently means the east side of the Kansas-Missouri line, because it damn sure don't stop in the governor's office in Kansas. Oh, God, the Mountaineers are going to have to play Kansas now in the Big 12. Oh, Jesus. For this, we traded the rivalry with Pitt to go and play Kansas? Reckon we won't be bringing the women folk with them. Sam Brownback might want to take control of their lady parts. Yeah. Governor Sam Brownback apologized Monday for his office's reaction to a Kansas high school senior's disparaging tweet about the Republican during a visit to the State House. My staff overreacted to this tweet, and for that, I apologize. Freedom of speech is among our most treasured freedoms, said Brownback. You know, when you Brownback, sometimes you get Santorum all over yourself. They're two peas in a pod, really. Brownback, Santorum. They were great buddies when they were in the United States Senate together. Couldn't separate them with a crowbar. My staff overreacted. Still not quite man enough to apologize straight up. That's one of those Repiglicken non-apology apologies they're so damn famous for. But this was the one I really loved. Freedom of speech is among our most treasured freedoms. Because all around Kansas, there's a whole bunch of gun-toting, Second Amendment-worshipping, penis-extension, 38-caliber, shooting off right-wing National Republicans.
Republican Rifle Association members going, what do you mean among the most? I better not be thinking that First Amendment's more important than the Second Amendment. Second Amendment's the one that Jesus gave us from the cross.
Yeah. The First Amendment is among our most treasured freedoms. Just among. And yet this guy is a religious goblolly. I thought it was supposed to... Because the First Amendment, you got your right to freedom of religion and freedom of speech and freedom to petition for redress of grievances and freedom of the press. But it's just among our most treasured freedoms. See, he can't say it's our most treasured freedom because there's states' rights for pig-licking nullificationists out there. What about the Tenth Amendment, Senator Brownback? What about the Tenth? That's the one that says that one up in Washington can't make us buy new insurance. That's mighty important. That might be more important than freedom of speech. It's among our most treasured freedoms. Yeah, it turns out Brownback's office employees, who monitor Facebook, Twitter, and other social commentary for postings containing the governor's name, saw Sullivan's message and shared the information with organizers of the Youth in Government program. This is from the Topeka Capital Journal. Yeah, really, really. Governor Sam Brownback, personal responsibility aficionado. Has a Twitter tattle squad. God, if we worked on that for a while, we could come up with something to rival Jack Webb and Johnny Carson's Copper Clapper Caper. Twitter tattle squad. But he's got one, and they swung into action. And they called the Youth in Government program and said, she was not properly respectful through the governor-nator of the great state of Kansas. So then the youth, and it was Sherry-Ean Jones-Sontag. Sherry-Ean Jones-Sontag, who was the spokeswoman for the governor, who said Emma Sullivan's tweet wasn't respectful. Was Sherry-Ean Jones-Sontag under the impression that Emma Sullivan was trying to display respect when she said he sucks? Mainly because he does. I mean, he bites. I mean, how would you want a 17-year-old to... Now, Lumpkin, come here. Instead of tweeting that he sucks, you need to say that he has very poorly placed policy priorities, which he puts into play with an imperfect understanding of human nature and human needs. Mom, that's more than 140 characters. Oh, but you have to have 140 characters for that Facebook thing? Mom, it's Twitter. Well, that's lovely. Is that one of your singing groups, dear? So, Sherry-Ean Jones-Sontag runs tattling to Shawnee Mission East Principal Carl Krawitz, K-R-A-W-I-T-Z. Last week, he told her actions were an embarrassment and gave her some talking points for her letter of apology to Senator Brownback. Now, there's one thing down here that's going to drive the right-wingers absolutely crazier than a sprayed roach. And that's this. The person, I can't really tell gender from the name, person who apparently initially noticed this. Had a name that, let's say, shall we say, was not particularly Methodist. And when I first saw it, I thought, wonder how many Kansas teabaggers will now begin swearing that Governor Brownback's office has been infiltrated by Sharia law. Because, you know, it's one of those names. Principal Krawitz says he has received hate mail. The hate mail I have received is a disgrace. I am not sure what will become of this issue. Unfortunately, this will probably get ugly. In Kansas? The state that did everything in its power a few years ago to declare that the earth is less than 6,000 years old? And they want to talk about ugly? So anyway, by today, Principal Krawitz had decided that no apology would be necessary. And the Shawnee Mission East School Board, District, whatever, issued the following statement. The district has not censored Ms. Sullivan, nor infringed upon her freedom of speech. She is not required to write a letter of apology to the governor. Whether and to whom any apologies are issued will be left to the individuals involved. Can we talk for a minute about a little something called prior restraints? And we talked about this in a larger context as well. And that is when you... Self-censorship. No, she's not... Ms. Sullivan's not going to have to write that apology letter to Governor Brownback, who owes a greater apology to every living human being in the state of Kansas for even occupying that governor's office, given his hateful, 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 right-wing, filthy, conservative policies. No, she doesn't have to write the apology letter. But because of the fracas that they showed that they could cause, she will now think twice about anything she says about government. And that's a damned shame. And that is a prior restraint. And that is a restriction upon her free speech. And it is, in fact, a form of censorship. Yeah, emails released by the governor's office indicated that Samir Arif, the governor's deputy communications director, sent an email on November 21st with the offending tweet to Burgett, a member of the governor's scheduling staff. Burgett sent a message that day to Deborah Brown, the Kansas director of youth and government program. Burgett wrote, "I would like to share with you a message that was brought to our attention, praise Jesus. I don't know." No, okay, I added the praise Jesus. "I don't know if this was someone with your group, but if it was, you might want it brought to your attention." And then Brown wrote back that she had contacted the Shawnee Mission East principal's office. "This type of behavior is not indicative of the students who attend the Youth in Government program. Emma was not one of the four students who met with Governor Brownback privately, and I'm not sure when she would have spoken to the governor. I am, of course, embarrassed for the Youth in Government program. My sincere apologies on behalf of all." You know what? I'm not embarrassed. And God knows if I was that little girl's parents, I'd be so proud I could bust. Because it's not just a whole lot of teenagers, frankly, who have the guts to stand up and speak back and speak truth to power. I think about the young woman who had the nerve to challenge Michelle Bachmann to a discussion a little test, not a debate, just a little test on the contents of the Constitution and American history, a challenge that Michelle Bachmann is dodging to this day because she knows that she would get her rear end handed to her on a silver platter. We should be proud of young women like Emma Sullivan when she has the nerve to speak up. When they have the nerve to speak up. Because the slipperiest slope to the end of whatever remains of our freedoms, that slicky slide is to be found in silence, in the quiet acceptance of the overarching domination of our ideas, our hopes, our dreams, and the very words we type or utter. But Brownback has apologized. And what's more, the Shawnee Mission East School District is doing everything it can to put a positive spin on things. Witness the following statement. The issue has resulted in many teachable moments concerning the use of social media. The district does not intend to take any further action on this matter. Is Sam Brown back up for re-election next November? I'm just wondering, because I got a feeling this would have, if they'd pressed it, this would have dogged him. Because even in a weird-ass place like Kansas, which is almost as weird as, say, Alabama or Mississippi, even in a weird-ass place like Kansas, full-grown men trying to whoop up and use the full power of the government on a little teenage girl, it don't play real good. And I have not seen yet, and I hope I do not see, evidence of right-wing hate being directed at that young woman, but I will not be surprised if, in fact, I do. Visit to the email bag. Kim in Michigan. Try being in Michigan with Rick Snyder. Now, this really, really sucks. You know what? There's something we can do with the Twitter. Start using that hashtag that Emma Sullivan created. He blows a lot. Whenever you want to criticize a governor, or a Republican, I should say, or in my case, a Democrat, a guy pretending to be a Democrat, use that hashtag. He blows a lot. David writing in from Tennessee. So let's see. The governor's staff turned the high school student into his beige shirts for Brownback. You don't get your brown shirt in Kansas till you take a shot at healthcare providers specializing in women's right to choose. Oh. Yeah. Beige shirts. No brown shirts till you've actually put a set of crosshairs on a physician in Kansas. Darlene writing in, what a jackass! This is so typical of Repiglicans, isn't it? They're so into bullying. Brownback was trying to bully this young teenager. What a jackass he is. Oops! Wonder if he'll try to force me to apologize now, too. Well, only if you're in Kansas. Ray noting the usual suspects, Repiglicans equal greedy, stupid, corrupt, and now childish. Surprise, surprise, surprise! Marty noting, in other words, there were some civil rights attorneys sharpening their pens, readying the lawsuits. Yes. And it would have cost the state of Kansas a small fortune, and the state of Kansas would still have lost. Ooh-wee. Now, so that's my number one Moran Monday nominee. But that is by no means the end of the list. And I said a little bit ago that the date you would understand why. This is 2011. Because Sam Brownback is, of course, a religious maniac who wants to force his views on everyone else. That's why he tries to govern according to the rules of his bizarre little faith. The most brilliant satirist on the internet, my good friend Eugene Finnerman, wrote yesterday, November 27th, 1095. I mean, come on! It's 1095! Now, see that doesn't have the same cachet as Jesus Christ, it's 2011. November 27th, 1095. Kill your way to heaven. On this day, in 1095, Pope Urban II, no, not the guy who's going to go be the football coach at Ohio State. No, different Pope Urban. On this day, in 1095, Pope Urban II gave one of the greatest speeches in history. Unfortunately, no one knows what he actually said. There are five different versions of what he was purported to have said, but none of them was written at the time of the speech. Only one chronicle, Gilbert de Nogent, claims to have heard the speech. One can question his memory, however, because he was writing 13 years later and evidently forgot that he was plagiarizing an earlier account. You can't get nothing past Eugene. The lack of a contemporary transcript is all the more amazing because the Pope was addressing a church council at Clermont, France. True, notes Eugene. There were fewer literate people in all Western Europe than on any street in Constantinople or Baghdad. But the majority of European literates would have been at Clermont that day. Furthermore, the topic of the speech was certainly memorable. In the 11th century, a crusade was more than just a glitzy term for a clothing drive. Even without a transcript, we can infer that the Pope had nothing good to say about the Muslims. He apparently offered an unsurpassed benefits package to anyone who went on the crusade. Remission of past sins, pardon for any excesses committed in good faith on the crusades, and reservations with a seating upgrade for heaven. By medieval standards, the Pope's offer was better than stock options. In March of 1095, the Byzantine Emperor had asked the Pope for help in recruiting a few hundred knights to fight the Turks. You see, the Byzantines there in Constantinople had a Turk problem. They were beset by them. A year later, the Byzantine Emperor found himself contending with the Pope's response, 100,000 crusaders. Whatever the Pope said, notes Eugene, it evidently was a great speech. It was, in fact, the birth of that massive, disgusting bloodletting, that demi-global hemorrhage that we refer to this day as the Crusades. And now you know the rest of the story. Have you been down to your True Value Hardware lately? Sorry. Now, do you see the tie-in? There's not a damn dime's bit of difference between Pope Urban II in 1095 trying to enforce religious compliance on people against their will and an equally religiously zealous Kansas governor who tries to legislate his religious morality onto the people of Kansas, some significant, if not plurality, minority of whom don't share them. To paraphrase Gertrude Stein, a crusade is a crusade is a crusade. They never stop. They never let up. They don't give up. They always come back. Just like that noxious wad of tissue is a full-fledged human being bill in Mississippi. We'll be back. And the price we pay for some degree of freedom from that kind of superstitious thuggery, the price we pay is our eternal vigilance. How many thousands and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people died as a result of the Crusades that Pope Urban II, the heir to the See of St. Peter, started. And his intolerance for others is no different than Sam Brownback's.
Freedom of speech is one of our most treasured freedoms.
Not up there with freedom of religion, is it, Governor? Didn't think so. So, Sam Brownback is the nominee. But frankly, that is a story, Emma Sullivan's story, is a story of victory. And we have another victory. And it, too, comes out of the attempt to suppress dissent. There's a journalist by the name of Sam Husseini. And Sam Husseini posed less than comfortable questions ten days ago. He posed some tough questions of Saudi Arabian Prince Turki Al-Faisal Al-Saud of Saudi Arabia, one of that sickening gang of scummy monarchs from the Saudi Arabian peninsula. Sam Husseini aggressively questioned Prince Turki Al-Faisal Al-Saud about the monarchy's rule and questioned the legitimacy of its unelected leaders. This was that moment.
First question, and keep your hands up long enough for me to remember where you were. 2, 3, 4, let's stop right there and go later. Go ahead, Sam.
Thank you. There's been a lot of talk about legitimacy of the Syrian regime. I want to know what legitimacy your regime has. Sir, you come before us, representative of one of the most autocratic, misogynistic regimes on the face of the earth. Human Rights Watch and other reports of torture, detention of activists. You squelched the democratic uprising in Bahrain. You tried to overturn the democratic uprising in Egypt, and indeed you continue to oppress your own people. What legitimacy does your regime have?
Well,
the billions of dollars and weapons.
Would you like to come and speak here? Give a speech? I will try my best, sir. Well, sir, I don't know if you've been to the kingdom or not. Have you been to the kingdom?
What legitimacy does your regime have?
Obviously, you haven't. No, you did not respond. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I advise anybody who has these questions to come to the kingdom and see for themselves. I don't need to justify my country's legitimacy. We are participants in all of the international organizations, and we contribute to the...
Do you notice how he changes how he changes the nature of the inquiry? Sam Husseini asked him to defend the legitimacy of the regime, the House of Ibn Saud, which is as illegitimate as any autocratic, dictatorial, merciless gang of monarchical thugs that still exist upon the planet. And yet, by the time that this pampered prince begins to answer the question, that's no longer the case. He says, you question my country's legitimacy. Well, jeepers, that's a line of reasoning straight out of the 6th century A.D., isn't it? The land is the king, and the king is the land, and the land and the king are one? I mean, that wasn't working for me in Excalibur or Camelot. Well, I guess in the case of Saudi Arabia, it would be the sand and the king are one, but you get the idea. Sam Husseini did not question the legitimacy of the country of Saudi Arabia. He did. In fact, you get the idea that Sam Husseini is all in favor of more self-determination for Saudi people, because you've got to remember that the Saudi Arabian kingdom, the Saudi Arabian kingdom, is a kingdom that lives, much as did the cultures of ancient Roman Greece, on the backs of slaves. These princes and princesses and princelings and whatever will not do their own labor. It is a slave regime with people hoodooed and hoodwinked and shanghaied into coming from India and Bangladesh and the Philippines and Malaysia and God knows where to come and work for the Saudi overlords. Has Sam Husseini ever been to the kingdom? Sam Husseini was still there to talk. It's pretty clear he hadn't been. Because if you talk like that in Saudi Arabia, you get your tongue cut out. But let us go back.
Welfare of people through aid programs, not just directly from Saudi Arabia, but through all the international aid agencies that are working throughout the world to provide help and support for people. We admit, as I said, that we have many challenges inside our country, and those challenges we're hoping to address. And we reform by evolution, as I said, and not by revolution. So that is the way that we are leading. By admitting that we have shortcomings, not only do we recognize those shortcomings, but hopefully put in place actions and programs that will overcome these shortcomings. I mentioned the fact that when he calls Saudi Arabia a misogynistic country, that women in Saudi Arabia can now not only vote but also participate as candidates in elections and be members of the Shura Council.
Still can't drive a car, though, can they, Prince?
And I'll just refer you to your own experience with your women's rights. When did your women get the right to vote? After how many years since the establishment of the United States did women get the vote in the United States? Does that mean that when before they got the vote that the United States was an illegitimate country?
No. But then again, Sam Husseini, as noted, did not say that Saudi Arabia is an illegitimate country. He said it's an illegitimate monarchy, which it is. But the fact of the matter is, yes, most of us who recognize and have a working understanding of American history recognize that, yes, there was a real legitimacy problem within the meaning of the social contract in which government is formed upon the consent of the governed, when half of the people, the female half, aren't allowed to manifest that consent or lack thereof. When another massive number of millions of people are not even acknowledged to be full citizens. So yes, Prince Turkey Al Giblets and Gravy Faisal Saud, whatever. Yes. Yes,
it does mean that our government lacked legitimacy. And there's nothing wrong with that. That party's got right. It's a matter of going. It's a matter of going forward and making things better. But they're still lopping off hands. They're still lopping off heads. They're still carving out tongues. And more than anything else, they are still a sick, sick, sick religious theocracy in which the power of the princelings and the princes and the kings and the queens and the princesses is all propped up by a gang of zealous religious thug monsters. The Committee for Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice, I think it's concerned, or called. And they are concerned with enforcing a twisted version of Islam that is called Wahhabism. Truly, was it Diderot? It wasn't Diderot. Somebody else will look it up and tell me later. But Saudis, to paraphrase him, Saudis will only be free when the last prince is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. Because it's a two-fisted chokehold that that the power structure in Saudi Arabia has over the people there. So thanks for pointing that out, Prince Turkey, Turkey Giblets and Gravy with Dressing on the Side and Cranberry Sauce of Saudi Arabia. Thank you. But I told you this is a story about winning. And this is a win. Because after he asked those questions, Sam Husseini got an email from the National Press Club telling him that, by God, he would be banned, suspended from the National Press Club for 2 weeks because he asked hard questions of the precious prince. People wonder why I despise royalty. Despise it. He was suspended for 2 weeks. Well, members of the media, for-profit and otherwise, raised a bit of a stink. And the press club lifted the suspension. Writing in response to the news, Sam Husseini said, "I welcome this decision and aim to ask ever tougher and sharper questions. I hope that others will as well. I had asked the Saudi ambassador about the legitimacy of his regime, but if tough questions are not welcome at the press club or at other media institutions, then their legitimacy is also undermined." But that's really part of the whole thing, isn't it? If you look on the Horn's Facebook page, you'll find that that Matt Osborne posted something there called "Time Magazine Makes You Dumb." And he said, the difference is not, the thing is, and he didn't use the phrase for-profit media, but it's not that they tell you what to think. It's that they tell you what to think about. And what he's done, or what he has there, I don't know if he did this or not, or if somebody else did, what he has there is a side-by-side pictures of several Time magazine covers. You know, because Time is published in Southeast Asia, it's published in Central America, it's published in Europe, it's published in yada, 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 and it's published here in the U.S. And for instance, one issue of Time, everywhere but the United States, the cover picture is of, I don't know, maybe it's Osama bin Laden, but the cover story is Talibanistan, talking about the potential Talibanization of Afghanistan. The U.S. copy is, "Should you be worried about anxiety?" I'm not kidding. And it was stunning in its obviousness. So congratulations to Sam Husseini. And congratulations to him for accepting the good news with a considered declaration of his intent to further press the thugs string-pulling puppeteer thugs of the royal house of Saud. Going back to Sam Brownback for a second, David in Tennessee with a little bit of background. Did you know that Sam Brownback was a Baptist growing up, striking an impasse in his career? He found, A, the big guy in politics in his region was Roman Catholic, rich, and had a daughter. B, he married the daughter after converting to the Church of Rome, tapped the family coffers, and was, bingo, elected. The rest, as they say, is history. Kath writing in from Canada, my Moran Monday nominee. I wanted to nominate Herman Cain for Moran. He's already on the for-profit media denying a story from yet another woman about her claim of an ongoing affair, and she has not even gone public yet. The best description of Herman Cain is from Spike, a friend on Facebook and the Horn, as he said, and you've heard our buddy Spike. I think it is fair to say Herman Cain is the new Coke of the GOP. Much hyped and promoted, fans turned on it. Now to bring back Classic. Of course, that begs the question, who is the Coke Classic? Well, that's Newt Gingrich. And dear God, I gotta tell you, I'm gonna miss Barney Frank. Barney Frank announced his retirement from the House of Representatives today. And it was kind of a well damn moment. I know. There's a lot of people that everybody's mad at somebody. But he had enough fire in him to fight back once in a while, and it was kind of nice. And Barney Frank was talking about what he might do in his retirement. And like I said, it's in moments like this that you realize we're going to miss Barney Frank.
Yes, I am. I did not think I had lived a good enough life to be rewarded by Newt Gingrich being the Republican nominee. It still is unlikely, but I have hopes. Let me say, for example, I intend to continue to be an advocate of public policy. I look forward to debating, to take one important example, the Defense of Marriage Act with Mr. Gingrich. I think he is an ideal opponent for us when we talk about just who it is threatening the sanctity of marriage.
You know what? You know Newt's already heard about that. And you know that he's stomping around and swearing like the Christian he is, cussing and carrying on at Callista. Because that hit him right amidships. And it was a, like I said, I will miss Barney Frank being willing to speak truth to power that way. So we've come to the end of this Moran Monday filibuster. There are still more nominees. Before we go to the break, I want to share with you a couple of... These are not Morans. These are people dealing with Morans. I saw this on my Twitter feed today, and I've got to just get to know this individual better because apparently he's doing his part in trying to advance the Australian fight, the Australian struggle against the coal thugs down there. And you remember when that offshoot of the Yes Men? You remember when they did that asthma puffer promotion brought to you by the Friends of Coal or whatever it was? that bit of brilliance? Well, there's something similar going on now in Australia. And they are taking an Australian AstroTurf PR campaign and turning it on its ear. And it's something called This is the Real Story. And this particular episode is called A Paid Extra. I'd love to see something like this take hold here. But in a way, this is how you deal with well-moneyed morans. Give a listen.
Water is such a scarce resource in Australia, and really, we've got to be making sure we're conserving and protecting water, because we use a shitload of it in our mining operations. I'm a paid extra. This is my story. I'm an environmental manager for a big coal company, which means shit all, really. My job is to taste test all the river water we pollute. This is beautiful country. My job is to strip mine it. We're even going to tear up my son's footy oval. Love going jogging right past all the riverbeds we're about to drain. Our environmental plan is basically to show you a whole lot of fields of wheat, even though wheat has nothing to do with mining, except maybe all the irrigation water we're going to steal from them. There it is, right there, yeah, little pond. Just get some big computers and use it to pump all the water to us. I think the main reason we need so much water is because we wash the coal with water. You're not quite sure why we do that, actually, and it doesn't really seem necessary. Maybe it's something to do with clean coal. There I am, wasting some more water. Just on the bitumen. There's a huge lake of water. So that's our little stockpile of water. That used to be a field of wheat. Now it's just trucks. Not that it matters for us, of course. We're not planning to stick around. By the time I've finished this job, I'm hoping I'll have a post overseas.
And it's from a campaign that ends, Australian Mining, the Real Story. And there's a wonderful website, and it's worth visiting. And if you happen to be listening in Australia, get involved with these guys. This is the Real Story. This is the Real Story. .com.au. Mining is booming. Profits have never been higher. If you're lucky enough to own a mining company, it's great times. Of course, for the 98% of Australians not employed in mining, it's a different story. The soaring dollar has wiped out the ability of Australia to sell other stuff to the rest of the world. Unless Australian mining starts putting back more into Australia, a million jobs face annihilation. This is the real story. Doing tremendous work and big it deserves much more attention than it's getting, so I hope we're doing our little part in just helping to spread it along. If you want to see the ad, because the video, what they've done is they've taken it's brilliant. I told you it's brilliant. They've taken the video from this AstroTurf greenwash BS from the Australian mining industry, and they've VO'd it, voiceovered it, with the I'm a paid extra, right? And so if you go to YouTube and look up This is the Real Story, a paid extra, it's amazing. Michael Kidde from the chat room said, this is genius. I didn't think I'd ever laugh so hard about strip mining and cancerous water. Love that Aussie humor. It is. Well, wait till you hear the Australian coal company owner boss. I love this.
Being a mining billionaire.
Wait a minute. Okay, so I got it's dancing about architecture, but I got to share some of the visuals with you. Again, this is from thisisthereelstory.com.au. It begins with the mining billionaire's alarm going off, him looking up at a liveried servant who then turns the alarm off for him. He's sleeping in a bed with the endangered skin of some creature. He then goes to the shower, where he washes with whale soap, and sits down to breakfast and proceeds to pour red wine on a cereal bowl full of caviar.
Isn't as glamorous as everyone likes out.
I'm Alan Billison, and this is the real story.
My day begins just like everyone else's. Regular commute. Regular job.
Perhaps we should look at reinvesting some of our $20 billion profit back into Australia.
Where you get to give something back.
Peter, don't be such a fool.
They're closing another factory.
This is a disaster.
I know, poor workers.
I'm talking about us. This is going to be all over the media tonight. They're going to make us look like the bad guys.
The mining boom has driven up the dollar, so the rest of the economy is struggling. But just because factories are shutting down unnecessarily, and it's our fault, and the minerals we're making billions out of actually belong to everyone, and we could easily source more stuff locally to help out the rest of the economy, does that mean we should? No.
I'm Alan's wife.
Are you actually going down to mine today?
Yeah, something like that.
Have fun.
To all the sacked factory workers, I'd just like to say that there's always plenty of work in the mining industry.
You're going to employ the 2,000 sacked workers?
2,000? Oh, well, we've got immediate openings for three people, 2,000 miles north of here.
Everyone's saying that we have to take the heat out of the mining boom. And Alan's job is to go out there and say, no, we have to keep the economy completely unbalanced in favour of mining.
Of course, we're not actually going to employ any of those people.
The truth is, we tend to hire people from overseas anyway. It's much cheaper. But it's not all easy.
I sometimes wonder how he does it. I think the money helps.
I've got it.
Why don't we set up an Indigenous employment program that goes nowhere?
Another one.
Yeah, it'll deflect attention away from all the factory closures. Who's got the most land? I'm sick of people saying if we lose our manufacturing industry, we're losing industries we'll never get back. Mining also contributes to this country. It's about digging things up and sending it overseas. People say I should invest back into the country, but if there's still something to mine here after I'm through, I just haven't done my job. Besides, this place is going to be stripped bare. And I need a view. I hear Bermuda's nice. I'm an Australian mining billionaire. And that's the real story.
This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Get away! Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Fourteen past the hour here on the East Coast. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. Conversation Radio, Moran Monday, well underway. And I told you I'd get an email about Barney Frank. Andy writing in. Way overrated securities industry hack. I'm sorry, he did more harm than good. We could have had Glass-Steagall back and a lot of other securities laws, but he made sure through quid pro quo for his personal and business friends that laws were not reversed, like the Commodities Futures Modernization Act of 2000, which outlawed energy trading regulation, credit default swap regulation, and mortgage-backed securities, securitization trading. This legislation completed under the nose of Representative Frank in a budget bill has done more than any other legislation to destroy our economic system. Mr. Frank provided a cushy job for a friend of Freddie Mac as a quid pro quo. Investor protections at the SEC completely fell apart, were neutralized when Representative Frank was at the helm. It was the wild, wild west. The securities industry has had free reign to rape and pillage the citizenry with Mr. Frank at the helm in the House. Representative Frank was a complete crony and corporate securities industry hack. Like I said, I told you. Of course, he was only in charge of a committee from 2008 to 2010. The rest of the time, it is worth noting that the Republicans were in charge of the House of Representatives, and he was a minority member, and we know how the Republicans treat the minority in the House. He certainly was not in a majority in the House when Glass-Steagall fell by the wayside. Not if I've got my dates straight. But I'm reminded, you know, the guy pushes back. He's got a sharp wit and he fights. And see, it's that he fights part. I'm reminded of when some sanctimonious somebody went to Abraham Lincoln and said, President Lincoln, you got to do something about that god awful Ulysses S. Grant. Now, he's drunk all the time, falls out of his horse, and smokes terrible cigars, and he graduated low in his class at West Point. He's terrible. You can't keep it. Why do you keep him on there? Abraham Lincoln looked at the guy and said, "He fights." You see, until then, Abraham Lincoln had a problem with really flashy generals with great credentials who really did a great job of marching their troops up and down the square, but wouldn't get into a scrap. Robert, writing from Australia, he says, with regard to that last piece there before the top of the hour, why am I hearing about this from the U.S.? If the Chaser boys hadn't done a bit on fracking recently, no one would have known it was happening. Ah! He says, our media isn't much better than yours when it comes to reporting what's actually important. And you see, where something like that's concerned, that's why it's the for-profit media. They're all wrapped up together. See, the same thing's going on in Appalachia that's going on in Australia. You're not digging coal there for your energy needs. You'll be off the grid fairly soon, or you'll be off of the coal-fired grid. Wind, solar, geothermal.
combinations of the three? Right? Yeah. They're digging it to sell it to China. And that business about we get workers from overseas, guess where overseas is? Here. I don't know if they're still running, but in the recent past they did. Ads for Australian mining companies looking for American coal miners to come down there and dig coal. Meanwhile, I turn the radio on here. Alpha Natural Resources is now hiring experienced miners. Except there aren't that many experienced miners because back in the early 1980s, in 1980 there were 100 and some odd thousand coal miners in West Virginia. In 2000 there were 15,000. Guess where all those experienced miners went? To the grave, and at best into retirement, because they were no longer needed, because the mountains were being blown up. But now that there's a little bit of a slackening in mountaintop removal, guess what? They need miners again. I told Robert in my response, I sent him the two links, and I said, how I would give anything to be able to go down and do a little rabble rousing with the folks rabble rousing in Australia against the coal companies. Because we're never really going to put a serious dent into any of this coal toxicity until we realize that coal is a global catastrophe. That it's not okay to strip it out of the earth in Australia. It's not okay to strip it out of the earth in Bangladesh. It's not okay to strip it out of the earth in southern Illinois. It's not okay to strip it out of the earth in Appalachia. It's not okay to strip it out of the earth in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming or eastern Montana or God knows Alaska. It ain't okay because it does no net good and a great deal of net harm. So, yeah. To the phones. You know the numbers, right? 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. That's if you need us to pay the freight on the phone call. If you can afford your own long distance, then, well, just dial 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey, so did you guys have a big feast or what?
Yeah, I mean, I was late to the table with it and stuff, but yeah, we were pigs.
Oh, good. Yeah. That always sounds good. But
and I could eat day-old dressing for about 3 weeks and not get fired of it.
I mean, I was disappointed that, you know, it didn't last that long, the leftovers. You know what I mean? It wasn't as bountiful as past years.
Well, I've got this one big stainless steel bowl, and it's huge, and there's nowhere to put it. And
so there was a huge mix-up, you know, amongst the family. Someone said that they were going to make some greens, so other person didn't, and it ended up canceling each other out.
No greens?
No collard greens, and I'm just, you know, I'm still ill. I'm tripping.
Okay, can we have a quick moment?
Shit.
Did you get macaroni and cheese? You know the macaroni and cheese thing, right?
Because it's a black thing, yeah. Pat Robinson, damn, you know I was rolling on that.
See, I was all ready for Pat on prayer meeting Wednesday. The interweb tubes went down, and there I am sitting with just a beautiful piece of perfect right wing. What do you even call that craziness? Hey, what is this with macaroni and cheese? Is that a black thing?
No, I'm sitting there sitting. Me and my friend was looking at it. We said, sister, you know you wrong to be on that show. That's what I was tripping on. I'm like, do not front talking about what Pat is missing, you know, that woman. But yeah, that was just hilarious to me. I didn't get offended. I just thought, good Jesus, this fool, go bench press or something, man.
But you know, I'm an absolute freak for mac and cheese.
Well,
any day of the year.
Well, that's why, you know, so I don't know what. You know, I don't know what he's talking about. I mean, everybody I know of all mixtures are all about the mac and cheese. I don't know. Maybe it's a generational thing. I have no idea. But
well, I mean, you know who introduced it to America, right? Mac and cheese?
No.
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson.
All right. Well, no, I'm just saying.
And then, and you know, that opens another door.
What? Yeah, well, you know, he introduced himself to a lot, I know. But
I didn't realize that whole genealogical thread you could put together, you know, they still can't prove whether he and Sally Hemings did. But you know what we know for a fact? Jefferson's wife was Sally Hemings' mother's half-sister.
Oh, well, no, listen, you know that. Yeah, please. the sort of colorscape in the U.S. during those times, it must have been just, you know, just a freak show up and down each coast. I mean, it just sounds crazy. But the mac and cheese, though, I don't, you know, who don't like that, though? Basically, that's my point.
I mean, I came back from one of my first trips to D.C., and we had had lunch in the house cafeteria. And they had the best macaroni and cheese I had eaten since they closed down the little cafeteria that I grew up going to on Sunday afternoons when I was a little boy in Alabama. And I couldn't get enough of it on my plate. Ferg was going back for fifths and sixths. I mean, and for Pat Robertson, what is this about this macaroni and cheese?
Yeah, no. It's just beyond. I mean, and plus, though, all I'm saying is everyone likes mac and cheese, and, you know, at this point, I don't even understand the distinction. I mean, because at our little gathering, you know, we have a whole mix of people in the family, and, you know, this time the white boy popped up with a sweet potato pie. I said, oh, snap.
Well, looky there.
It was good. I said, you need to pony up with that versus, you know, the dude is hella masculine. I'm looking. And he popped up with the pie. That shit was out of this world.
Well, you know, the best sweet potato pie recipe I've ever had in my life came from our chat room moderator, Lottie. And it is some kind of good, flavored with a little bit of brandy. Whoa.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, well, I don't know what it, you know, Elijah made this pie. It tastes fantastic. So anyway, basically, Pat Robinson he tripping. And that woman shouldn't even went along with that song and dance. That's all.
Well, I love the fact that the whole thing begins with Condoleezza Rice, though. That
well,
just
no, exactly. That's the main thing that I was tripping on. And she's talking about once or twice a year. I'm like, please. Real please.
And then, lo and behold, I'm trying to enjoy some college football. And what have I got? What have I got on Saturday night? I've got Stanford playing Notre Dame. And there she is on the sidelines at Stanford. And not even talking to anybody, but just kind of like staring off into space and tapping her toes to music that only she hears. And I'm like, oh no.
So there, what, Condi? Well, she wasn't with her girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever.
Well, that or he or she was out of the frame.
Oh, right. How interesting. Yeah, so I don't need to see her. She's been popping up a bit lately. What's that about?
Is she the designated person for rehabilitating the Bush administration? Is she
I
mean, did they do some private polling and find out she was the person that the Bush administration creature that people hated the least?
Yeah, well, I think so, because, I mean, you know, it's kind of, I mean, I think that she's just as bad as any of these other high government officials in the Bush administration, but she doesn't really rub me the wrong way as badly as some of the other creatures, like Addison and Wolfowitz and those people, really. They really.
Yeah, that whole stick the comb in the mouth and then run it through your hair image.
Yeah, no. It's too much for me, those people. So she, I don't know, maybe she's the one they put out there, because she's still, it's pretty popular, I think, you know what I mean, as far as like.
Well, they cut away to her in the football game, Sandra, and the next thing I know, those two Poppin' Jays who were behind in the booth, you know, it was, oh, God, it was awful, Sandra, it was just awful. It was Brent Mushberger.
Oh, no, you know what? God, you know, I mean, you know, it's time for glory. I'll just say it.
Yeah. Well, him and Pat can go together.
It's time.
But they were talking.
It's horrible saying that, but I can't stand him. Anyway.
He took time to say, you know, it's not too late. She was once asked what her dream job was, and she said, commissioner of the NFL.
Yeah, well, I wish she had done that instead of what she did, though. That would have been great. If she had been the NFL commissioner.
Well, see, then there's that whole weird psychological dynamic with the man she once referred to as her husband, the president.
Her husband.
Because remember, he used to say that his dream job was to be commissioner of baseball.
Oh, I know, and that would have been just wonderful, too, wouldn't it?
You know,
it's
a whole parallel universe. It's one of those things that they have to do Nova specials on PBS. You know, what if George Bush had gone on and been commissioner of baseball and left us the hell alone?
That's a stepping on the butterfly. Yes.
Right.
One of those modes. But listen, the other thing that was killing me was that freak from the family, Brownback. God, he is, you know, his fascism just flared out. He had to back the hell down, though. I thought that was good.
Oh, he's just gross. And yeah, he is part of it. He's part of the family. He's part of C Street.
Right, which is, you know, and those people are pretty much they're into sort of I don't know, sort of having a Saudi Arabia on the Potomac, kind of.
Well, or, you know, yeah, in the, or Saudi Arabia, right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they, you know, I mean, so he, I couldn't believe that his office people thought they could get away with that. And, you know, what's up with the principal? Wow, the authoritarianism is just...
Well, the funny thing is the principal made a point of saying, I'm no fan of Sam Brownback. Like, you know, no, I'm a liberal.
No, but the principal is wrong in this, and he looks really bad in this story too. The teenager is like, what did she really do? She didn't do nothing. She just exercised some activity on a social networking app. What's the problem?
Right, you know, she was. I guess.
I mean, are we at a point where we can't, you know, I mean, this is just a taste of what it'll be like when they get control of all organs of the government. It's just, and it's really, it's nothing else but sort of fascism, because you can't say anything about the Fuhrer. You know, that's what it struck me as.
Yeah, it is that, and it's so typical of them, Sandra.
Yeah, this, me, but it's like, but at least the, you know, between that and the other story you said about the reporter at the press club, I'm so glad that happened, because that one was so concerning to me. I'm like, wow, you can't even ask these global elitist questions now?
Apparently, no.
And I guess, you know, the pushback, I'm glad there was a lot of pushback, because I was appalled by that. It's like, you know, that slimy regime, it can't be questioned on American soil. I was thinking, wow, we really are adrift.
But, you know, there's other countries you can't ask questions about, too. And I happened to see this one roll across my radar earlier this afternoon, Sandra. A New York Times reporter covering Israel.
Oh, the Libby Zip, that woman?
Yeah.
The foreign minister? Oh, yeah.
No. She was crossing from the occupied territories into Israel. She's pregnant. And she says, I don't want to go through the X-ray scanner. I'm a reporter. I'm pregnant. And so instead of trying to do something else, she was instead marched through the X-ray scanner 4 times while Israeli soldiers looked on and laughed at her.
4 times?
Yeah, and then they strip-searched her.
Okay, what kind of reporter is she? Is she, I mean, what is she, American or?
She, yeah, from the New York Times.
Okay, so that would be, what's the recourse? Nothing? She's just... writing about it, or?
Well, you know, here's hoping you don't have a flipper baby.
Well, no, that's, yeah, well, you know, I mean...
But here's the denouement, I suppose. In an incredibly rare instance of something approaching self-examination, the Israeli government apologized to her.
Oh, they've been apologizing a fair amount lately. I think that they're starting to feel the pressure, you know, and becoming a sort of South Africa type state is maybe starting to weigh on them. Because
yeah, but when you're talking about however many Curies or Rentgens or whatever we're measuring it in, however many of those that have passed through this fetus, apologizing after you put her through it 4 times is a little. There's a little bit of closing the barn door after the horse is gone to that.
Well, no, but they shot some American in the head dead, and they still ain't apologizing.
No, that's true. I don't think that's on the list.
You know, I just mean that the sort of rogue state mentality is Israel at this point. But I don't know. That's horrible. That's horrible for her and her unborn child. Good night.
Yeah, she's a photographer for the New York Times. She said... she's also a Pulitzer Prize winner, by the way. Her name is Lindsay Addario.
Well, I'm sure the excellent, what they would tell her is, you know, you shouldn't be traveling and pregnant. That would be the response I expect from.
Actually, what the Israeli Defense Ministry said was, we would like to apologize for this particular mishap in coordination and any trouble it may subsequently have caused to those involved. Security's tight on the border with Gaza, quote, in order to prevent terror from targeting and reaching Israel's citizens. They said, Dario's request to avoid the X-ray machine had not been properly relayed. I guess her papers were not in order.
Oh, yeah, you know, papers, please. Yes, you're right. That is an example of that. Yikes.
But the Defense Ministry's apology came after a protest from the New York Times bureau chief in Israel, a guy named Ethan Bronner, I guess got behind it. He said he's glad that they plan to have changes, but the newspaper remains shocked at the treatment Dario received and how long the investigation took.
It's just horrible because of this poor woman and the danger that her child may face. God, wow. Unbelievable. And that's supposed to be the liberal democracy in the Middle East. Wow.
Yeah.
Thrilling. Hey, interesting. Did you hear about this judge who said, sorry, SEC, you know, can't let you slap a Citigroup on the wrist. Have you heard about this story?
Yeah, the settlement was for something like $285 million. The judge turned down the settlement because the settlement allowed Citigroup to neither admit nor deny liability.
And he said, basically, he's sick of that whole paradigm. He said it's neither fair nor reasonable, nor adequate, nor in the public damn interest. And I'm just like, you know what? Now, I'll make a stretch here, but I will swear to God that this Occupy Wall Street is getting up in everyone's head for real, though.
You know, I thought of that as well, because it's, do you think that would have been the case a couple of months ago?
That's what I'm saying, because the whole conversation and narrative was deficit, 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 austerity, austerity, on and on, 24 hours a day, when austerity, you know, has even never been associated with America. That's the thing about that word that really gets to me. It's like, where the hell did that come from? I never heard about that word. No time in American history. In Europe, yes, but not over here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so now all of a sudden this is a second word out of everybody's mouth. Anyway, the Occupy Wall Street, you know, is the meme and the framing is, if anything else doesn't happen, is fucking brilliant. Because it's so hard to escape from what the reality is if you frame it in that way. And I'm not saying that this has anything to do with it. I think this judge is just like, wow, you know, the courts aren't in a position to work this one out without more information, basically.
And, of course, the immediate complaint was that this will put a kink in the SEC's attempt to do its job because no dirty-ass bank wants to admit that it did wrong, and therefore they won't be able to settle these things as quickly.
Well, they'll just use their endless, you know, they'll threaten to use their endless line of lawyers and endless bottomless pit of money to draw it all out. But I don't care. I just think that any sort of line in the sand at this point, because they're just getting away with everything and just throwing up pennies on the dollar as a means of doing business. The price of fraud is just these little penalties, you know?
And that's the thing that kind of got to me, because I read the story and I didn't see the details. I'm looking through it again here, hoping to find them. The settlement was for $285 million.
Yeah.
Okay. If the settlement is for $285 million, would you care to guess what the actual exposure was?
Well, that's what I'm saying. And you know, in lieu of this Bloomberg blockbusting story that appeared yet over the weekend where, you know, the Fed have basically bailed out the financial industry to the tune of $7.7 trillion, I repeat, $7.7 trillion.
Yeah, I saw that story, and that trillion dollars thing
That's why I said to you, out of space. We're back in the space. Again.
Right, yeah, we're back in the numbers that only physicists can deal with.
Right. And so, you know, it is just the same old song. I mean, I'm getting sick of hearing my voice about it, but it's just, like I said, until there's some sort of accountability, I just don't think things are ever going to get right until we get some accountability with this bloated, parasitical financial system that's sort of really taking over the world. And, you know, I'll give props to our very smart friend in Sweden. You know, I mean, yeah, he pretty much right about what he was saying, because I'm now thinking that, you know, even Germany is not even in a position to sort of withstand what's going on with the sort of no undemocratic rule by emergency shock doctrine shit that's being applied to sovereign states.
Yeah, and I think the thing that Scott pointed out, that the troubles seem to continue to persist in coming from former fascist states, that there is some degree of commonality there. I don't know quite how it all plays out, but it's sort of unavoidable.
Well, but what's really disturbing though is, for Germany, though, you know, they struck a bargain by unification. They agreed to subject themselves to this wider monetary system, right, as a means of, you know, controlling their ambitions, let's say. So they agreed to it, and they don't have their own currency anymore. They have to tie it up with the rest of the states that have the euro. So they're kind of in a catch-22 situation, you know, I have to say. Because now they're being squeezed by the U.S. and the rest of the world to solve this problem, you know, by subsuming their constitution and their, fiscal orthodoxies that they've been running for years.
And again, I go back to being that little history nerd that I am. That's another one of those good things don't happen in Germany moments when you put financial pressure on them.
Well, yeah, but they're, you know, but it's really kind of, I mean, because they should be the first country to kind of offer some leeway to debtor nations, too, having been in that situation repeatedly, you know. So
right, but once again, isn't it a manifestation, Sandra, of the fact that the banks are running? I mean, isn't this just perfect proof, clear as a bell on a winter's day, that, again, yeah, government responsibilities and government sovereign capabilities, duties to the electorate, that kind of, is all subsumed under the thumb of the banks.
Yeah, but also, and there seems to be just one bank, Goldman Sachs. I mean, I don't want to drift into conspiracies, but I'm sorry. All these people, when you scratch them, they all work for Goldman Sachs, because that Monty person, it's like, that man ain't never ran for an office in his life. And now he's the head of Italy? Excuse me. And he worked for Goldman Sachs. The head of the European Central Bank worked for Goldman Sachs. The new prime minister of Greece worked for Goldman Sachs. I'm sorry. I am very disturbed by that, considering Goldman Sachs got Greece into the the Eurozone fraudulently in the first place, right?
Right. And so the question keeps popping back up. How do they do this? I don't mean to sound like a simpleton. How do they do this? How does Goldman Sachs get away with it?
It's incredible. I mean, I suppose if they think they can operate under this undemocratic rule by emergency for a minute, then they'll be able to go back to a democratic process. I don't really know. I'm not too sure what.
But that sort of thing, if you take the long historical view, that sort of thing seldom happens. One seldom pulls back from the authoritarian brink.
Well, it certainly would be easier for them to go back than for China to, say, allow for some elections to happen. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
They would never do that. But, it's just really bizarre because I just don't really think at the end of the day the populace is going to put up with the level of pain that has to come without some sort of debt jubilee, you know?
Somebody's getting a haircut somewhere, in other words.
Yeah, I just don't see how, I really don't see how it's going to work out. And this whole idea of the IMF bailing out Italy to the tune of 600 billion euros, which is another rumor that's floating around, which is apparently why the markets were okay today, which that's really strange because you know who funds most of the IMF.
Them again?
No, us.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. Yeah.
And, you know, Obama today was talking about, we're not going to use taxpayer dollars. And it's like, now, man, you just opening your mouth and it's just lies. Like, what's going on? Because what are you talking about? You know, the drawing rights, you know, whatever they're talking about, you know, each country pays a portion of the they contribute to the IMF. I know our percentage is pretty high. It's like 20% or 17%, but it's the most. So I don't know how that's going to work.
Well, it certainly
without us having
and our contribution is part of discretionary spending, isn't it? I mean, is that
it's a contribution, just like we pay for a portion of the rather large portion of the UN. You know,
because see, I've got this graphic in front of me that they kindly produced over at. Over at Think Progress, and it's there's a big, big, big black square that says 2012 federal budget discretionary spending, and 59% of it, or $553 billion, is the Pentagon. The next largest is other, transportation, labor, NASA, and so forth. 6% is health and human services. 6% is education. 4% is housing and urban development. 4% is the Department of State. 2% is energy. Remember the Department of State, since we were talking about Pat Robertson, remember when he wanted to set off a nuclear device in Foggy Bottom? Yeah, that Department of State. 2% energy, 2% justice, 2% Department of Agriculture. Where's, and I don't want to sound like some sort of damn teabagger, where's the money coming from?
You know? I asked the same questions about where the $7.7 trillion came from, too. You know, the Fed, which is...
Well, that's a breathtaking story.
Well, which is our version of, you know, the technocratic nightmare, because that is an unaccountable... I don't want to go Ron Paul on us, but that is a totally unaccountable entity. It's stunning. They fought 2 years, Bloomberg, to get... to keep Bloomberg from getting this information, and they finally got it through a... Foyer Act. You know, they were fighting really hard to keep that information out. And it's just like, wait a minute. You are not accountable. You can't be accountable to banks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's so bizarre. I don't really know. I mean, that story is still kind of doing my head in. But
I love it that this Gary Stern, who was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis 1985 to 2009, says he was, quote, wasn't aware of the magnitude of the bailout, $7.77 trillion.
Yeah.
And
don't forget the $13 billion in profits they've made off of it, too. That's
right.
That's the other shoe that dropped. It's like, are you kidding me?
The way they come up with the number, this is at they say, add up guarantees and lending limits, and the Fed had committed $7.77 trillion as of March 2009, to rescuing the financial system, more than half the value of everything produced in the U.S. that year.
Yeah, no, we're like a $14 trillion GDP, hell. Yeah, no, I mean, it is absolutely stunning. And in the meanwhile, like I said, the housing market at this point may never come back. And it's just kind of like, you know, when are they going to deal with that? Because my understanding is that unless they're able to sort out the whole underwater situation, which means a literal write-down of principal or whatever, debt forgiveness on the debtor side, we're just going to be bouncing along the bottom for the next 20 years, if you believe Stephen King. You ever heard of him?
Yep.
Yeah, he just came out with some, like, I was like, good Lord, you know, what... And he's, what he says to do is you're literally going to have to pay off the debt of the debtor now. That's what has to happen.
And how does that happen?
Well, it happens, obviously it becomes a political...
Because when I hear pay off the debt of the debtor, I begin reaching for my wallet.
Well, no, I guess you literally would, for say you start out and you forgive the student debt that's $1 trillion. That kind of stuff. And the reason why I'm saying it now is because...
Okay, I understand a little better. Because... I just have this vision of, that we're going to pay off the debt of the debtor by, getting a big bag of little Friskies for Granny.
No, it's literally, I got the impression, at least from King's example, you give the money to the person and they are required to pay their debts off first. And if it's a jubilee, everyone has to get pay. This is the thing. Otherwise, he's looking at it as a systemic solution. And it may sound crazy, but in lieu of $7.7 trillion to prop up something that isn't working anymore, well, shit, his idea is as good as anybody else's. You know what I mean?
Because every other idea put forward thus far has been, just a failure?
Well, and it's just propping up a system that is obviously, can we say faulty? Yeah, as an understatement.
Can we say failed?
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I don't really know.
Happen to read that article from the David Frum article? I forget which day I saw it. It was long and it was kind of scholarly and wonkish. This is David Frum, who was a White House speechwriter who got drummed out of the Republican circles for saying that the Republican Party had gone crazy.
Yeah, no, I didn't read the article. I think I saw somebody reference. What is it? What was it? The main.
Well, it was profound because he is doggedly determined to find that handful of Republicans that still exist in this country who haven't gone completely crazy, and he has apparently been subjected to something approaching outright ostracism for doing it. And you combine that with something that Bill Clinton recently said, which is, he said he thinks Obama's going to be okay against whoever the Republican nominee is. And he said where Republican Party politics is concerned, you cannot have presidential ambitions if you have anything more than a double-digit IQ. And those were his words. I mean, there seems to be a real connection out there that 20% whatever margin bunch that is the teabaggers really are dumber than a bag of hair, to use the phrase I had in an email the other night.
But the
problem is there is enough of them, Sandra, to stop the sane people.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. And I mean, but on the other hand, though, I don't know what y'all is listening to, but apparently, a newspaper in Vermont endorsed.
No, that was New Hampshire. That was the Manchester Union Leader.
Right, and the reason why they didn't endorse Mitt Romney because they said he was the 1%. And I was like, bingo, I don't care. If these people are using that language, listen, Romney's in trouble because he is the epitome of the 1%. And it's pathetic when he tries to talk about himself being unemployed and the middle class, and everyone has his number. As far as I can tell, he has a hard row, a hill to climb.
Well, I think you make a very valid point with regard to the fact that that phraseology, that image, that messaging has crept even into Republican circles, and that's pretty strong language coming from the New Hampshire Union Leader, Manchester Union Leader. By the same token, however, they endorsed Gingrich instead.
Yeah.
Now, how is that, sorry, bastard, not the 1%?
Well, no, exactly. No. It's
Tiffany,
confused.
Greek Islands, Cruz.
Yeah, no. It's definitely confused, but it is going in a better direction, shall I just say, because Mitt Romney is he would be the mouthpiece for the 1% beyond the beyond. I'm not saying that Gingrich wouldn't either, but there is something appalling about a Romney presidency, too, to me. And I'm not saying that Newt Gingrich is any better. I just don't see him being able to defeat Obama. I don't know. Maybe I'm delusional. I can't see him defeating him.
Well,
but Romney, I'm a bit worried about because of what's backing him. You know what I mean?
Oh, there's some really creepy stuff backing
right.
him. But the thing that's troublesome about Gingrich is that A, he's Georgia boy, okay, and B, even though he is the 1%, struggling dirt farming, hayseed chewing Southerners have never been particularly loath to follow a millionaire to their own detriment. And so, where the difference being, I think there's a hell of a lot of Southerners, and the Republican Party has got to have the solid South, okay?
Right, that's the only way they have even a look see.
Right, and they nominate Romney, and there's a whole bag full of stay home in Mitt Romney.
Yeah, no, I just think, and you know, well, anyway, I don't know. I just thought that the reasoning that was given just once again,
yeah.
See the language. Used. I don't care. I was like, oh wow.
But you talk about creepy people behind Romney. Are you familiar with this really gross guy, Steven Schwartzman?
That name is familiar. Yeah, refresh.
Okay, he's worth about $4.7 billion.
Right.
He's the CEO of Blackstone, the largest private equity firm in the world.
Nasty. Okay, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, when the Democrats tried to close this tax loophole, it was called the carried interest loophole.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the one that says that hedge fund managers and so forth
15% one?
Yeah, are taxed at 15%.
Right.
And Warren Buffett had a purple polka dotted blue screaming hissy.
Yeah.
Well, Steven Schwartzman responded by saying that closing that loophole, well, this is the quote, it's a war. It's like when Hitler invaded Poland in 1939.
Well, that's right. But the thing is that, you know, I mean, the capital gains tax or whatever the hell, it used to be like 39%. You know, it was double.
Yeah.
It was double. So don't tell me that, you know, we have to have capital tax at a lower rate because of some, you know, it needs to be because it needs to be invested or whatever excuse they have for it. It's not really playing anymore.
Well, and here's the punchline, Sandra. Next month, at his Park Avenue apartment, Steven Schwartzman is hosting a humongous fundraiser for Willard Romney.
Yeah, right. So I mean, this is the thing, but and so to have their media point that out. You know, obviously Romney is not very liked in his party, you know, because...
Oh, there's a lot of people that just outright despise him.
Yeah, so this all bodes well for President Obama. It has to. I think it's going to be a lot of blood spilled in the primaries. I got popcorn. because they're nasty, and Mitt Romney is the absolute worst for me to be president, you know, because I just think it would just kind of be, I don't know.
It would be that smarmy veneer of piety that Ronald Reagan pulled off to such a T. But yeah, I mean, the Manchester Union leader is correct when they say he's the 1%. Listen to some of these details on Steven Schwartzman. I mean, this would gag a maggot, okay? His personal chef often spends $3,000 for a weekend of food just for Mr. Schwartzman and his wife. Stone crabs that cost $400 or $40 a claw. And of course, he's vociferously fought against the Buffett rule. He won't release his tax returns. well, Romney and Romney, no, I mean, Romney won't release his tax returns. But you know, this guy isn't even the 1%, Sandra.
Well, no, that's the.
This guy is the 1/10 of 1%. Yeah. This guy is the 1/100 of 1%.
Right. Well, and that was I don't know if that was Krugman or somebody was making the argument that, you know, shit, within the 1%, you know, it's like the, you know, it's a 0.001. Against the 99.9, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it really is.
Because these people control so much wealth and so much power within our governance. So,
see, that's one of those troubling memes that has gotten around, this idea that if you make $250,000 a year, that somehow you're middle class.
That's no, not when the median is like, what is it now, 52?
Half of the United States makes less than $50,000 per year.
So, I mean, you know, no, if you're making 250, no, it's a joke. We already are getting into the Guatemalan model, as far as I'm concerned, you know, relative to the U.S., because we have all these people who make less than, say, $60,000 a year. And then you have the people above. So that's probably about 16%. So what does that leave? That leaves like 85% kind of, I don't know what that is. You see what I mean? So it's already 2/3 of the people are already on their way to Guatemala.
Yeah.
And,
full on peasantry.
Right. I mean, and so we're already, yeah, it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. But
I understand what you're saying about Gingrich. I mean, I heard maybe it was on Morning Joe or something a while back, but somebody said America will fall in love with Newt Gingrich just long enough for him to actually start being Newt Gingrich again.
Well, yeah, I mean, no, it's you know, he is almost, I can almost say he's like his own worst enemy, that guy.
Right, and, you know, on the one hand, back before Thanksgiving, when he announced that all the janitors need to be fired and that, you know, child labor needs to replace them, and he kind of doubled down on it, because now he's announced that everybody getting any kind of federal aid needs to be drug tested first.
Well, and that argument is so absurd beyond belief. I mean, it just doesn't hold water at all. I mean, Rick Scott made sure we saw how that worked in practice. It doesn't.
Well, no, and it got struck down, too, right?
Right. Yeah, because it's a completely farcical and a real invasion of...
Well, it's constitutionally loathsome because it is a search without suspicion.
Right. No, it's too much. It's outrageous. But, you know, I know he's a horror show, too. Don't get me wrong. But I just...
That line about him... I heard it and I've stuck with it, and it's the absolute perfect description. Newt Gingrich is what a stupid man thinks a smart man sounds like.
Well, yeah, exactly. No, I know that one made me chuckle too. I just thought, oh my God, that's perfect for that freak, you know. And what you played, you know, Barney Frank, that queen is off the chain. I almost spit out what the hell I was drinking when you played that. Funny. I'm sorry.
I love it. I love it when somebody will push back.
No, he ain't even messing around. So I know that what Andy was saying about him, you know, it's true enough. I mean, he could have squashed a lot more regulations, but I certainly will miss, you know, the bitchiness, because he hella bitchy, and that was hilarious. And it was great that he just sort of decided to blow that up today, you know?
Yeah, although, you know, just one more seat to worry about in 2012. I don't know what his calculus was, that his seat would be safe, or he had a handpicked successor. Or...
Well, no, but see, I'm, you know, I really am. So, there's another story that came out, which is very troubling about, you know, our sort of governance. This whole insider trading, that story is outrageous. Scandal, the idea that the Congress of the United States is blatantly doing insider trading. I don't know what's the whole story, not to be just huge, But it's a major story. This is an outrage, and I'm waiting for it to pick up steam.
Well, don't hold your breath.
Well, yeah, I know, but it's pretty...
Because the poster child for that is Spencer Baucus from Alabama, and the man has a committee chair.
Yeah, well, no, I just...
And Republicans don't investigate Republicans. They skew strictly to Reagan's 11th commandment, thou shalt not criticize another Republican.
No, but it didn't even have any sort of traction until that 60 Minutes stuff. And, you know, now there's a fair amount of scrambling going on. Because the Congress approval rating is 9, and it will probably go lower.
9.
But the worry there, though, is that when do our... politics and governance become completely illegitimate. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I think when you get to 9, they kind of haven't they?
Yeah, it's pretty bad, you know. So, like the technocratic madness in Europe, you know, I fear that the super committee, you know, was a taste of that and, you know, maybe more to come. So it's a bit of a worry. I'm not a big fan of Congress, but I'm more scared of having no Congress. You know what I'm saying?
Right, where they just delegate all their authority away.
Yeah, which is... Anyway.
Yeah.
I'll let you go.
All right. You take care, Sandra.
Bye.
Bye now. Didn't even get to ask her about Tim Tebow's triumphant game yesterday. That's getting to be a little bit troublesome, that Tim Tebow. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Oh, yeah, it's Keith and...
Oh, hey, Keith, what's up, man?
Not much. I just like Tim Tebow incredibly. I mean, going out to sports, and one of the things I've always loved about your show is you're one of the few, like, left-wing liberals who, like myself, enjoy sports immensely. And being a Jets fan, I now hate Tim Tebow twice as much.
Well, I mean, Jesus, you know, it's gotten to where the highlight reel is like having it's like having a vasectomy without anesthesia or something, because all those guys who were saying Tim Tebow is no count are now saying, yeah, but he sure does win. My grandmother could win playing the schedule he's been playing. You know, that was the San Diego Chargers. That wasn't the Packers yesterday.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, I mean, it was also a reeling Jets team that was out of breath by the time they let him finally score in Mile High Stadium. Because one of the things that happens when you go to Mile High, which I now is called something else, I'm sure, but is, you know, the adjustment most teams have to make. You know, you literally by the fourth quarter are reaching for oxygen. So
yeah,
and you really saw that during that game. I mean, the Jets were like literally trying to catch their breath by the end. But that's beside the point. I mean, I'm a long-suffering Jets and Mets fan.
Well, you know, our blogger Texas Betsy is a long-suffering Jets fan too. And you know, at the beginning of the season, it was all, you know, it's going to be the, who was it said it was going to be the Jets and the Eagles in the Super Bowl. You know,
well, the best laid plans of mice and men, what can I tell you?
But being a Jets fan in the NFL is a lot like being a Cubs fan in baseball.
Yeah, you know, they did give me my one moment, though, which was like being 12 years old and watching Joe Namath run off that field with his, you know.
With the finger in the air.
Yeah, that was pretty cool, you know. Especially because my father, who was like, you know, the right-wing Republican Navy guy, was like, the Colts are going to destroy them, blah, 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 you know. So that was pretty cool. And I did at one time, the best sports vacation I ever took was when my son was about 6 or 7, we went to next spring training. He got to meet Mike Pelfrey, who was wonderful, came to his room and talked to us for about 45 minutes. And then on the way home, as I walked past first class, there was Joe Namath, and I got to meet Joe Namath. So that was pretty cool.
Oh, that is neat.
You know, but yeah, that was neat. That really was neat. But you know, being a Mets fan is also, especially living in a city where you're surrounded by Yankees fans, is also rather difficult.
Yeah, it's kind of like they took the Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers and wrapped up all of those long-suffering fans, moved the other teams to California, and then created the Mets just for the masochistic joy of it.
Oh, very much so. And believe me, we relish it. I remember years ago because I've never baptized my son or anything because I don't believe in any of that stuff. Though I do believe in some aspects of Christianity. But someone said to me, well, what religion does he have? And I said, I made him a Mets fan. It's a lot like being a Christian, you know. You wait in vain for miracles. And once every week or so, we go to Shea Stadium with 50,000 other people, kind of suffer in unison watching the team, you know. So.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like the way a lot of us used to feel about going to Mountaineer Field in Morgantown when Don Nealon was still the coach there. There was an old gag that went around that said, what do Don Nealon and Billy Graham have in common? They can both get 60,000 people to jump on their feet in a stadium and scream Jesus Christ.
You know, sometimes that about sums up the mess, yeah?
Yeah.
But the Mets will always stay in it until about August, so they give me something to watch for about 3 months, and then they fall apart.
Oh, yeah, and from the details department, yes. It is now Sports Authority Field at Mile High Stadium.
Oh, okay, that's good to know. Okay.
God.
I guess it changed since Obama spoke there, because I think it was something else then. I guess another because now stadiums change every 2 years when a new corporate sponsor takes
place. Yeah, but none of them changed quite as fast as they got the Enron off of Enron Field in Houston.
Oh, okay, well, that's true. Okay. But as I said, I find that also. You know, like, I really felt City Field should have been named, like Shea Stadium was named after William Shea, who really was instrumental in getting a National League team back in New York after, you know, and the whole story about that forming.
Yeah, for as obnoxious as Comiskey was, you know, it's Comiskey Park.
Right, and, you know, it's the same thing with, I mean, couldn't we name it, like, Jackie Robinson Field or, you know what I'm saying? Something that had to do with the history of baseball, no, we had to name it City Field. And the funny thing was, as City Field went into full swing, the economy collapsed.
Right, and City was a big part of it.
Oh, it's still an amazing part of it, you know.
Aren't the Mets somehow wrapped up in the whole Bernie Madoff scandal still?
Yeah, it appears that the Wilpons kind of did have money invested in Madoff. And I think it was something like they managed to get some of their money out before the shit hit the fan, and now they're being sued by the people Madoff swindled to try to get some of that money or something like that. That's where I think that all came in. But they certainly took a hit with Madoff somewhere because it seemed all of a sudden going into like the 08-09 season, they had no money. Hello?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay. Sometimes my phone just buzzes. So yeah, so somehow they are involved somewhere. Like it seems the Mets, as they moved into City Field, also became like the debts. You know, they all of a sudden owed all this money, had no money, which is why like keeping people like Jose Reyes and stuff is going to be a near impossibility. So you know, it's just the nature of New York baseball, you know.
But you know, I got a real kick out of the sense of urgency that all the sports media had for announcing that an agreement had been reached that would create a 66 game NBA season. It was as if the subtext was, thank God somebody's given us something to talk about besides Joe Paterno. And they no sooner had that on the front burner of the stove than the whole fine thing comes out with at Syracuse.
Yeah. Well, you know, none of that really surprises me. I also truly believe that the percentage of gay athletes in this country is probably far higher than anybody will ever admit to or know.
Well, if the general population is extrapolated into sports, then that means that 10% of professional athletes are gay.
Right, and I would probably say it's probably closer to 20 or 30.
You ever heard Tim Tebow give a press conference?
Yeah, and I think very much so, just because many of the people I have known through my life who have been jocks and stuff you know, these were, some of these people were the people who on the camping trip, you didn't let them into your tent, if you know what I mean. A lot of them were closeted gay people. I mean, which is why they were so macho and, you know, so.
Well, and it, and it's so sad that that culture still obtains in sport, that people can't simply be who they are because of that, that sort of, that macho butch culture.
Yeah, which is really sad because, you know, as I said, I've always had suspicions over many athletes who, you know, especially the ones who marry Miss America and stuff. You know, people like that, I'm always like, well, my guess is they were.
Like I said, just, you know, go to ESPN's website, Keith, and look up Tim Tebow's little press conference from yesterday.
Okay.
If that guy doesn't set your gaydar off, you don't have any.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't surprise me. You know, it wouldn't surprise me. As I said, in my own lifetime, being someone who was always, I always knew I was straight, but I was always someone who was different. I would always be accused, and I'm a nurse who works with AIDS patients, you know. So I know, one, I have a very good gaydar, and two, I was never gay. I always knew I was never gay. I was just, you know, I always knew I liked girls. But, you know, if you're different in this society, somewhere around 13 to 14, you hear the faggot words a lot and stuff.
I know more about that than I care to admit.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of us do, you know. And it never surprised me. As I said, I think probably if we ever could honestly find it out, we would find that in professional athleticism, it's twice the normal rate of anywhere else.
It wouldn't surprise me in the least.
You're probably dealing with a lot of, because a lot of these men are men who enjoy the company of men, who are very, you know, many of the things.
Well, did you hear?
Any of my gay friends.
Did you hear any of the tape, surreptitiously taped telephone audio about the Syracuse story?
So
the victim. And it just gives you an idea of the scope of this thing. It's kind of like the scope of the Sandusky thing.
Also, the latest victim that came out is also up on sexual abuse charges with, I think, a 13 or 14-year-old boy.
Well, this isn't that one. This is one who has been trying to get his case heard since 2002, okay, and relating to things that went on even before that. So he surreptitiously, and ESPN's Outside the Lines or whatever the show is, has the tape, and they played it repeatedly last night, played the tape of the alleged abuser's wife saying to the victim on the phone, "Listen, I know what my husband is like. He's not interested in me. He just needs to go and find some gay guys and enjoy himself."
Which would be, you know, I mean, that's the whole thing that's always gotten me through the years is, you know, I really, you know, I fully believe that people who are gay are born gay. There's no doubt in my mind about it. Most, you know, I've worked with gay men my whole life. I know a lot of gay men. And, you know, they were born gay, and it's okay, you know.
But the thing I think,
their company, they're lovely human beings, many of them. What is so sad is watching people who torment themselves because they can't admit to who they are and then go out and live their life.
And see, we have to be careful, like with I think even the Fine scandal, and certainly with the Sandusky scandal, not to be pulled into that trope that this is a gay issue. It isn't.
Oh, it's not.
Because when somebody is molesting a little child, it's not even sexual. It's power driven.
Of course, and
it's violence driven.
Yes, and I can assure you that the vast majority of gay men and gay women in this country are not pedophiles. You know.
No, the vast majority of pedophiles in this country, right, the vast majority of pedophiles in this country, almost to the point of exclusivity, are straight people.
Oh, yeah.
But
it's a whole, very much like rape, which has very little to do with sexuality.
Little if anything.
It's power.
Mm-hmm. Dominance, violence. Oddly enough, all the things that authoritarian right-wing ideology, I hate to use the phrase even, gets off on.
Oh, very much so.
And that's why you constantly find them hiding there.
Oh, very much so. I mean, I would agree with you 100%. On to economics and politics.
Onward, yes.
Yes. It was a very, very interesting 2-3 weeks. Last time I talked to you, Zuccotti Park was still there. And I guess Zuccotti Park is still there. It's just now barricaded off with, like, a ring of NYPD sitting around it and private security agents. And you have to be checked before you can go in there, which I find it fascinating that Bloomberg's whole speech was, well, nobody else got to use the park. Well, now nobody's getting to use the park, except occupiers who still go in there. But now we have to go through this whole set of checks, you know, to have a general. I mean, it's sickening. And unfortunately, the day it was raided was my birthday, which was, like, horrible. I remember sitting at work at 1 o'clock in the morning. I turned on the live feed to see what was going on, and boom. Instead of getting a speech by Keith Olbermann or something, what I saw was this guy running around, Klieg lights, you know, tear gas. I was like, oh, my God. So I promptly showed up that next morning at 9 o'clock at Duarte Park just to be counted, and it was really a sad thing. But at least 35,000 people showed up in the streets on that Thursday, which was very good. And I think this movement is here to stay. You know.
I still tend to agree with you. I know there are some who don't think so, but I tend to agree simply because there's not going to be anything happen in the coming immediate future that would cause it to go away.
No, if anything, there will be things which will cause it to even multiply more. And one of the things is just, again, I think to me at least, it's become very clear that 1%, that power elite, they are scared shitless. That's why you're seeing the police responses. That's why they're calling up mayors saying, get these people out of your city right now. They're scared. They're scared because for the first time in God knows how many years, people are becoming aware, and people are starting to stand up for themselves again. And I don't think for a long time that was happening in this country, you know. I mean, Michael Moore says it really well when he says, if nothing else, it ended the apathy. It made people believe again that maybe we could do something. That might actually have some kind of positive effect, and it already has. I mean, the tone of the conversation has changed completely. We're not sitting there thinking, how many more billions can we cut away? We're at least starting to talk about things like fiscal inequity. Unfortunately, as you and Sandra were saying, and I tend to agree, I truly believe that, you know, I mean, this country and the world is being run by about 7 investment banks. You know, I don't think that's so far from the truth.
Right, because no sovereign nation can exist without them because of the structure, the debt structure that we have put up around the business of governing. And you know, that really is, Keith, a problem for the 21st century, figuring out, A, how we undo this knot, and B, how we don't get ourselves back into the same mess. So
it's going to be quite a problem to solve, and I don't think it's going to be solved easily. Nor do I think it's going to be solved very cleanly.
Well, it has to start, I think, with some basic education. And you may remember a few years back, there was a brilliant little piece of animation called The Story of Stuff. And it was just stick figures and line drawings on a white background being explained along the way.
Because I never saw that one.
Well, okay, so watch that one first.
Okay.
And it's basically an explanation of the history of consumerism and why it came into being. Well, about 2 weeks ago, the same woman who was integral to the creation of The Story of Stuff released a new piece, and it's called The Story of Broke. And when I say that before anything can be fixed, it has to there has to be a de minimis level of education that obtains, I'm talking about things like the story of Broke. The story of Broke explains the financial meltdown in terms that a sixth grader can get.
Right.
Now, granted, that leaves out the vast majority of the registered Republicans in the United States. But if we take the remainder and at least get educated enough to talk about it...
Well, we can get at least 60% of the population to figure it out.
Yeah. And that's enough to start getting some stuff done.
Because the other things I would tell you to listen to are George Carlin's routine on stuff. I don't know if you've ever...
Yeah, and the whole thing...
I mean, he calls it shit, but it's the same thing. You know, it's like, you know. And George Carlin... There was something on MoveOn.org had put up his piece, but it's something I have seen many times before, and that's the whole one on the owners. I don't know if you've ever heard that routine of his. Pretty much that, you know, why is education suck? Education sucks because the owners don't want you to be smart. You know, the owners want you to know enough to go in, operate your little machine, go home, watch your little TV, and go to sleep.
Yeah, well, it's Field's third law, Keith. Don't smarten up a chump.
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, I see that every day in our education system today. I mean, my kid is back in public school now because I couldn't afford to keep paying for private school. But thank God, we found our neighborhood has one of the best junior high schools in the city. But it does things that most junior high schools don't have. He has two teachers in his classroom for 30 kids. So we're back to a 1-to-15 ratio, which is good. His school is co-funded by NASA, and he's learning all about climate change and such. But I realize this school is one in a million. It's quite frightening. Where education has gone in this country. I teach my own child history because if I don't teach it to him, I don't think he's going to learn it. I teach him, you know, he's learned about things like Howard Zinn's view of history along with a more, you know, let's say traditional view of history. And I'm constantly reinforcing this stuff to him. And it's, you know, but I don't think many parents do that. And it's sad. Because, you know, if you don't teach people history, they're bound to repeat it. I mean, this has all happened before, you know? I mean, go back to the progressive movement at the turn of the last century. Go back to even things like Shay's Rebellion after the Revolutionary War. You know, it's all been there, and it just blows my mind that so few people are just aware of it.
And there's so much of American history that the people aren't aware of, and that's, you know, that's part and parcel of why I so very much enjoy doing things like the Dr. Bill Prism American History Chats that we'll be having another of tomorrow evening.
Some of those have been great. I've really enjoyed listening to some of that you've had on. Because it's really integral that people learn what really happened, you know.
Yeah.
The good old days weren't so good, is how I often put it. And that the good old days also had, people should read about the progressive movement. The progressive movement was amazing.
And it was born, Keith, out of absolute heartache and hard times and desperation. So, Keith, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I was hearing some. Okay, no, the progressive movement's history is brilliant, but everything that led up to it is so important as well. There are parts of American history, and that's part of why I enjoy what Dr. Bill and Keith Lilly do so much, that we really don't pay attention to. It is as if we deal with the Revolution and maybe the ratification of the Constitution, then you get Lewis and Clark, and then bang, there's the Civil War, with maybe a mention of the Mexican War somewhere somewhere along the way. You know, I've mentioned that I've been reading this history biography of Aaron Burr, and it's fascinating to me to contemplate that everything that Burr was talking about doing allegedly all came to fruition within another 30 years, 25 years. And that if frankly Aaron Burr had gotten away with it, it might have been a dramatically different country. And the other thing to come out of that is the fact that there have, and it's worth remembering in the context of all of these nullification attempts that various and sundry Republican governments are trying to do within the several states, breaking up the United States has always been a subtext to our entire national being, whether or not we should be a union or not. And it didn't, people tend to think that that starts with the Civil War. It didn't. It started practically the minute that the Constitution was ratified. There were elements of it in Shays' Rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion. There were three rebellions within the first Washington presidency, weren't there? Something like that, or within Washington's presidency?
There was the Whiskey Rebellion. Those are the two I know the best about. Shays' Rebellion.
And then by the time that Jefferson comes into office, and I found this fascinating, the guy who drops the dime on Aaron Burr is a guy named General Wilkinson. Okay? General Wilkinson was the general of the army for all intents and purposes, and he was posted in New Orleans. And the man had been, for as long as the United States had been in being, a paid spy in the service of the Spanish crown. And therefore, everything that he did, and including ultimately dropping the dime on Burr, he did to satisfy his masters in Spain. And yet we hear about Burr being the traitor, and General Wilkinson was basically allowed to go to a corpulent old age, when he should have been hanged out of hand. It's absolutely fascinating and absolutely not known, generally speaking. You know, here in West Virginia, we have a historic tourist attraction, an island in the middle of the Ohio River off of Parkersburg called Blennerhassett Island. And that is where, supposedly, a big part of Burr's conspiracy was hatched. The only problem being, nobody can quite agree what was hatched there. And it's fascinating business. This country has always strained at its own seams. And it's funny because it's always been people with a get-rich-quick scheme or people motivated by money who have wanted to break the union that was formed. I mean, even the issue of slavery was an economic as well as a moral issue.
Oh, very much so. I mean,
and how many hundreds of thousands did those patrician planters of the old South lead to their doom just so that they could continue to own other human beings? You know, that's why I continue to make the assertion the best thing that might possibly have happened to the United States would have been to hang a few Confederate generals and Jefferson Davis. And say, you know, we'll have an end to this. Because had they been hanged, you know what? Rick Perry might not be standing in Austin, Keith, saying, well, we need to consider secession.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I consider the word secession to be a vulgarity among vulgarities.
I would have to say, you know, it's... I mean, it's interesting, even if you read people like, I think it was it Madison or Monroe, one of them was talking about, you know, slavery was just economically so advantageous to him, he couldn't stop it.
Yeah, and now you've got these Republican nominees for the presidency, or these Republican candidates for the presidency. Was it Rick Perry last week who said, we need to have a new Monroe Doctrine for America? Well, when I was in elementary school, the Monroe Doctrine was presented to us as something noble, whereby the Monroe administration had said, We're going to protect the rest of America, the rest of the Americas, from foreign meddling. Well, it turns out it was no such thing. It was the United States saying, if anybody's going to meddle in these countries' affairs, it's going to be us.
Yes, and which is what we've done for 200 and something years. I mean, believe me, being a nurse who works with a lot of West Indians and such, they'll tell you no on certain terms, you know. Why did I leave Jamaica to come here? Because you've made Jamaica economically impossible for me to support my family in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every the right...
You know,
those weird right-wing expat Cubans in South Florida get their panties in a twist over Castro and communism. But you know what? They never seem to get the same degree of worked up about Haiti. And the difference between Cuba and Haiti is that Cuba had a degree of self-determination that they were allowed to have without the influence and meddling of the United States, whereas the United States has meddled without let-up in the affairs of Haiti, and look where it got Haiti. You know, and I still maintain to this day that the perfect models of Haiti, or the perfect models of the Ayn Randian, Austrian school of libertarian laissez-faire economics, you know, if you really want that, then just get the hell up and go to Somalia, go to Haiti, and have a whale of a good time, because there's your free market.
Well, the fact is, so much about Haiti was, not only was it the first, you know, black republic, but that Haiti, if it was not for Haiti, this country would have never been formed the way it was. Because the reason Jefferson was able to buy from Napoleon Louisiana, on pennies on the acreage, was because after Napoleon sent his brother-in-law into Haiti to put down the slave rebellion, recapture Haiti, and begin a Caribbean empire of his own, well, his brother got his butt kicked by Toulouse Louverture and the Haitian generals, and basically Napoleon put his, you know, arms up and said, well, hell with this. Let me get out of the Americas. I'll sell this to the United States. I'll sell off Louisiana and use the money to conquer Europe. So, and that's something very few Americans understand.
Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely.
The Haitians, you know, we would have never had Louisiana.
Right, because Napoleon couldn't get his troops freed up out of Haiti to come and garrison Louisiana, which is part and parcel of why he wound up having to sell. It's been a wonderful conversation, Keith. I'm awfully glad you called in. And don't be a stranger. We will hopefully have another of these conversations soon.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
25 minutes before the hour, and we continue onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey there. It's Chris from the 90.
Oh, hey, Chris. What's up?
Just got through with an election. I ran for city council up here.
You ran?
I ran.
Awesome.
Learning experience, my God, learning experience.
Well, I have no doubt of that, but you know what? You got off your duff and did it, and I applaud you for it.
Well, had to be done. One, you know, I can't keep talking crap and not going out and putting my thing on the line, as it were. So I went out, did it, and I got a bunch of paperwork to fill out, and that's that. Got to... Interesting, though. Got 460-some-odd votes, 480, somewhere on there. And need to think that there are 400 or 500 people out there that think I would be a good choice as counselor. I mean, that's reassuring. You don't think of how many people didn't vote for you.
You know what? It is reassuring, and frankly, it's an opportunity for you to go out and try to find those people.
Well,
and start talking to them, start the political process of magnifying and amplifying your voices.
Well, I think, speaking of voices, the first thing I'm going to have to do next time is make sure I don't lose my voice. Got a hell of a cold out of the little one coming back from daycare, and lost my voice after tossing my cookies. And that's just not something you should do as a politician.
Well, no, it is frowned upon. But then again, at least you didn't tattle to any high school principals over somebody tweeting something nasty about you. So, you know, you're ahead of the curve on that.
There is that, yeah, there's the high bar.
Not in American politics, it's not. No. You can't even limbo the bar so low in American politics.
Yeah, measure it with picometers or something.
Exactly.
I'm really hoping our politicians don't learn much off of yours. It's just getting pathetic up here. It's just mediocre. It's not even freak show quality. I mean, Michelle Bachmann, she's a freak show all on herself. And listening to her is actually entertaining. Listening to people talk about how crazy she is entertaining. Listening to ours are like really, really boring, mediocre village idiots. They're just wandering out and they're talking to other village idiots and they're all nodding their heads in mindless symphony. It's terribly depressing. I mean, you watch American politics or you listen to American politics, you read up on American politics. Entertainment, if nothing else. You know, it's engaging. You can expect that the people participating at least have a pulse.
Well, American politics is the merger of the entertainment state with the information state. And as a result of that, you wind up with Michelle Bachmann, Newt Gingrich, Ron Paul, any of the loonies.
Well, for every Michelle Bachmann out there, there are quite a few good politicians. I mean, people who will put paid to what they're talking about, like Barney Frank, for God's sake, you know. Congressman with guts down in Florida who got districted out or something.
Oh, Alan Grayson, yeah. Or, yeah, you know, Bernie Sanders. They're in the Senate. But the problem is one of, you know, we're allowed to have a few tokens of those. We're just not allowed to have a bunch of them.
Well, it's just a society should make use of its extroverted yahoos. I mean, not everybody can be a radio talk show host, and I'm glad you're up there with, you know, the practice and, you know, the ego enough to at least have started. Now you're onto it, so you don't have to worry about, you know, doing something terribly novel. It's just what you do every weekday or something. But we don't make enough advantage of those people in our society that are different.
Well, you know, I'm going to start using that phrase. I'm Bob Kincaid, extroverted Yahoo, Chris, if you don't mind. I love that.
No problem. It's just, you know, it takes a little bit of gumption to get up in front of a big wad of people and talk about anything, really. I mean, just ask any high school student who's ever had to do a presentation. People who can go up there and just talk and talk and talk, very rare.
Oh, I reiterate that story that was done by Toastmasters or whoever a number of years back that surveyed people on the things that they feared most in life. Number two was death. Number one was speaking in public. It's the truth.
I'm not kidding. I spoke at the Occupy Nanaimo, just got up there and thought, hey, maybe I can do this. And talked and talked and, you know, I got about halfway through my little point and then I decided, I'm going to get the hell out of here. So maybe I've got a lot more practice to go through. It's kind of interesting, too. I've been listening to Brad fill in for Mike lately, and he's the election integrity expert par excellence. I mean,
he is that.
Fiction writers write about him, obviously. So I started looking into it, and, oh, there it is on election day, a Diebold optical scanner device in Canada in a municipal election. They had the recount on the 23rd of November. I went in there, talked to the nice lady, and has anyone actually looked at a single ballot to see if it actually was counted rightly? Well, I tested it before the election, but you can't test them
right
during
the election. The only thing you can do is make the machines, once the machine has spat out the number, the only thing a recount is to make the machine spit out the number again.
Exactly. I mean, convincing the woman that the second virus ever written for any computer was a cron virus that worked by dates, and we've had innumerable viruses that go on or activate at a certain time, you would think that that would savvy her to the fact that maybe there's one for these things. But
yeah, but for a computer professional to try to explain to a computer layperson the very simple concept, and I'm certainly no computer pro, I've just learned some stuff by dint of hard experience. You are the pro. But to simply try to explain the concept of garbage in, garbage out, forget it.
It shouldn't be that hard. I mean, this works on accounting. If you just put random numbers into your ledger book, you don't expect to have, you know, the Venus Delilah come out of the other end. But the unreassuring thing that she stated was that when I asked her, it's like, are you interested in making sure the computers actually did their job? No, I'm completely assured that they did their job correctly. Will you look into security threats to these machines that have been proven to happen on exactly these machines by all kinds of people all over the planet doing security threat analyses on these. No, I'm not interested at all in looking into this. Okay. Will you do a single recount on one vote just to make sure it worked after the election? Even if, you know, the virus is turned on and it failed to turn off at the appropriate time, maybe you could catch a really bad programmer who hacked an election by catching it afterward.
No.
I have absolutely no interest in that whatsoever.
Well, and see, and in many instances, they may very well be contractually prevented from doing that stuff, Chris.
Not as such. They've actually bought them and didn't sign a damn thing. It's kind of neat. A lot of our city documents are open source. And if they buy something, they have to put all the contract stuff and all that up online. You can check it out. It's like, oh, okay. Bought this. No obligations. No long-term servicing agreement. Just bought. And if they break down, they call up Diebold, and they get them to fix it. The laws in Canada are very much different than in the States. The cable companies found this out to their regret. If you transmit something into someone's house, if you sell someone something and they bring it into their house, it's theirs. If you don't want people to get cable because you sell cable and that's your business model, you have to stop the signal from getting to their house. As long as you've got a signal coming in, if you're broadcasting it through the air, I can do whatever I want with that signal. This is one of the reasons behind the what they call green chips for satellite television. Anything that's in your house is yours. There's no I partially rented off of you any of this. The judges and the Supreme Court have put a sanity test on that thing. No, you either sell or you lease. If you're leasing and they violate the agreement, it doesn't matter. It's still in their house, even if they're leasing it. If I lease a truck and I make an illegal modification to it, a modification to it, you can fine, but you can't fine any more than the price of the truck. So the replacement cost of the Diebold machine is something like the $200 thing. So even if they did get fined, you can't get fined more than that. So again, the laws in Canada are quite a bit different, but they don't like to advertise that. Also, the laws online are that you can download anything you want, just can't make a profit off it. You can't resell it, that sort of thing. But they just before the election, they had this lovely consultant guy come in and tell us all about what the hell we're getting ourselves in for. So that was tired, actually. Anyways, have him come in and tell us, you know, what's, Roycroft Consulting Services. Interesting. Listen to him and talk about, you know, one thing you can get kicked out of office for is an ethics violation. The one thing you can be charged for as a public official is an ethics violation. Failure to do due diligence, that sort of thing. And he's stressing this 8 or 9 times over and over again. Due diligence, ethics, due diligence, ethics. Act responsibly, blah, blah, blah. And then I hear this election official telling me that she doesn't want to look into how her job is done, look into news or new information regarding how her job is going to be affected, or possibly confirm that what she's doing is actually correct. She is absolutely having total faith in one source of information, and that is all. And she considers that her due diligence, her ethics, her moral obligations, all these things. I literally, because I took place in the election, have standing to bring her up on suit. Now, it may not be successful, but I can at least compel them to do a physical count of at least one counting center to confirm that. Now, at the point, I'm getting out of chutzpah at this point, and I'm running up against that wall of, do I really have the whatever it takes to do that? Because I've had no experience with the legal system whatsoever.
Right.
I mean, you've had a cup of coffee in law school, as you said, but I don't even know the place to start. Do I go talk to a clerk? Do I talk to a lawyer? I know where corporate lawyers are. I know where criminal lawyers are. Just because.
Yeah, but there aren't a lot of shingles hanging out there that's a, you know, election specialist.
Yeah, or just human rights lawyer, or civil rights lawyer, or constitutional lawyer, or just general lawyer. You know, they're always specified into very specific things, and honestly, election law doesn't have a lot of good experience in Canada. There have been a lot of violations over the years, and Election Canada generally handles it internally. It's regulated to the point where they don't need to go to the courts anymore. They have appropriate fines, appropriate redress mechanisms, they order re-election, they order this, they order that. Elections Canada has a lot of sway. So it usually doesn't get to the courts. So you have to have a really good lawyer who can study up on the appropriate legislation and then advance the cause. But we don't have things like corporate lawyers that could do it, or even down in the states on a state-by-state level or municipal, county-by-county level or a national level, election lawyers, lawyers that have actually had experience with an election. And this is one of the problems with having a nice socialist state where things are regulated and kindly officials administer a very selective system that's not creative in any way and leaves nothing to the imagination and is very dull and is very easy and anybody can do it. That's why we set it up as a government job. Is that sanity tests aren't readily available because it's already been set up to be sane to allow lawyers to cut their eye teeth on. So when something does come up, it's one of these novelty things, and you need a legal extroverted Yahoo in order to pursue it. And I know the comfort.
Well, you mentioned kind of running up against that wall. I would not hesitate in the least to suggest, Chris, that you at least touch base with Brad, because you know he really is an honest to God compendium of information, and if there's an organization in Canada that addresses these issues, they can at least take you down that road a ways.
Well, here's one other issue: is that Canadians are terribly polite. Terribly polite to the point of it's a psychosis. If you're impolite enough to suggest somebody's honor is infringed, let alone that somebody's placed themselves in a position where their honor is questionable because they've taken upon themselves too much responsibility, they haven't covered their own ass, they've acted less than professionally, or without due diligence, or what have you. Canadians will respond to that, and why are you attacking this poor woman? She's just doing her...
Just an honest job. Public servant.
Yes, and that myth is still there, regardless of how pusillanimous or lazy intellectually or otherwise they are. And the people who know better are not in the minority. And unfortunately, TV has made inroads into this country that I don't even like to think about.
I know how bad it is when I know who played in the... I know how bad the saturation has gotten for me, Chris, when I know who played in the Grey Cup. Okay? I know.
I'm shaking my head here. You can't see that. But yeah.
Because it was the Vancouver British Columbia Lions, was it not?
The Lions, I didn't know they were actually called the Vancouver British Columbia Lions. I thought they were just the BC Lions.
Well, maybe they are the BC Lions.
That's lovely.
Because I think the game was played in Vancouver.
It was. We dropped off a whole bunch of people going out there and saying, "Yeah, we're gonna go see the guys playing the baseball, football game."
Yep.
Oh, it's like American football. Yeah, American football is great stuff.
Only with slightly different rules. That NFL fans can't understand.
Yeah, and the best thing to do if you're not a sports buff is just go out there and slander. Did you hear about the quarterback guy? Oh, Johnny, whatever his name, Johnny Speedo or whatever, right? He's like, yeah. Have you heard about this gay lover? What? It was in the newspaper the other day. Oh my God, no! Check it out when you get home. And then they'll spend the whole game just thinking about that guy's gay. Ruins the experience for
You're a cold man, Chris. That's okay. It's beautiful.
Now there's something completely different. I was trying to mention to you a little thing that I learned off the feminist networks that I've been listening to. Again, trying to expand my mind, trying to get out of ruts and acculturation and all that crap. Listening to a lot of weird people that I've been told are wrong about everything for a long time, and I'm figuring best to question that and make my own mind up. So I'm going through the list of people you shouldn't listen to and trying to make up my own mind. Got to the feminists, and just as a thing that they just discarded as a throwaway line, like it was totally obvious to everyone, like feminists that they were talking to, sort of preaching the choir territory, the difference between the personal and the political. And this is something that I don't think any other interest group could have ever brought to the fore because of the nature of women's politics and the sexual tie-ins and all the other crap. Is that the difference between personal and political, where it's a personal issue and it's not up for debate and it's between you and someone else, or it's up to your decision whether you like ice cream or not.
Right. For instance, why are we having a political debate about the individual choices a woman makes with regard to her own reproductive health?
Yes, and the feminists are in a unique position to really see this in the contrast that's necessary to just be kind. But the difference between the two, the reason you transit from one to the other, is whether or not you derive pleasure from the issue at hand. And I honestly would not have gotten that unless
Whoa.
I had listened to the feminist.
I'm going to have to let that one...
The abortion thing is such a thing. It's the whole, the rape, the sex, the abortion thing, why women's rights is such a contentious issue, where you always have on one side people arguing it's a personal thing, and on the other side it's a political thing. And considering it's from your own perspective, this is actually, until we either give up reproduction or give up being psychologically human, I don't see this actually ever being resolved. It's literally part of the human psyche.
Well, and because the vast majority of the people attacking the idea of women's reproductive rights, women's political rights, women's any kind of rights, are almost uniformly men, it isn't going away because it goes to that sexual dynamic. Men are essentially right-wing authoritarian men, Chris, are very, very nervous about their power, and they are terrified of the prospect that somehow or another this is going to make them not be able to do the nasty no more. The right-wing man... You know, I'd say he's a caveman, except I have too much respect for cave people.
Cave people were still human.
Well, they were not just still human. They had, at certain time periods, hunter-gatherers had more equality and more leisure time than any human since. And they also managed, because of the role that women played in those tribal societies, they also managed their populations in such a way that they didn't in their nest. So, you know, there's that. But that is a profound way of breaking the two things out. And since you mentioned Occupy a few minutes ago, the ultimate 99% 1% breakout. I saw a statistic run across my Twitter feed the other day that just blew my mind. And it was this. In the world, not in the United States, in the world, women, all the women in the world, own 1% of the property. Men own the other 99.
Holy.
Yeah. See, I said the same thing.
So much for matriarchy. Jeez.
Yeah.
There's my acculturation speaking again.
I mean, that's the...
rant, anti-theist, and I'm still...
So something on the order of 50% of the globe owns 99% of the property. That's including poor men, rich men, and every man in between. And that is a stunning thing to contemplate. Chris, I've got to roll out of here, but it's awful good talking to you, brother.
Thanks for the chance to vent.
Oh, always a pleasure. Vent more, please. Bye now.
Cheers.
And congratulations to Chris for actually for going and running in that election. That does me so much good to hear. And, hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. Thanks a lot for having me on. This is Tim from L.A.
Oh, hey, Tim. We'll get you in there one way or the other. Just kind of do it auctioneer style.
Okay. Yeah, quickly, what I want to do is give, you know, the Monday moron to our mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, because 2 months ago at Occupy LA, he said, and it's in the LA Times and different newspapers and on TV, that the occupiers, we can stay, remain in front of City Hall as long as necessary. And a couple nights ago, he said that we're going to have to move because of, you know, health reasons and whatever. Well, last night, around 12:01, he ordered LAPD and the CHP to, you know, I guess it was a show of force, or it was just a fear tactic or whatever, to come by. They said, we're going to remove you. Well, what happened was that they didn't remove us. And people were actually leaving during the day, you know, the day of or a couple days before, because they said there's 72 hours, blah, blah, blah. He essentially lied to the people, lied to us, lied to everyone, and said that, well, you're going to have to leave. So now there's a group from Occupy LA who's filing a federal injunction to prevent us from leaving from there, because the Constitution said we have the right to assemble in a public park and, you know, in a public area, which is City Hall, and voice our grievances. But also at the same same time, the California State Constitution says that we do have a we have a right to do the same thing too, even in, you know, a public private public area. For example, there were some people arrested because they were protesting in front of in a plaza in Bank of America. I don't know if you saw it on TV or whatever. And they arrested the people there. B of A, I guess, did the citizens arresting and arrested the occupiers. Then I found in the California Civil Rights Code that doing so by intimidating, threatening, or coercion, or to interfere by threat, you know, interfering, you know, our constitutional right to speak, we could sue. Each person could sue per person, whoever was involved. So see that there's like 30, 40, 50 police officers, plus Bank of America, and in our case, you know, City Hall, plus the command staff, and $25,000. So see that there is 1,000 people involved totally. 25,000 times 1,000 people total.
That's too much math for me to do on the fly, Tim, but it doesn't sound good.
$25 million.
Wow.
Each person, me, and say 1,000 other people. Now, we were spreading this stuff around. We were spreading this law around our civil rights around, you know, the encampment. Because, again, the mayor said, and the city council said, we have the right to be there. And we can stay as long as we want. And then, again, last night, he tried, you know, the mayor tried to show, like, a show of force. And at 5:30 in the morning, the command staff of the LAPD said, oh, no, we're not going to remove anyone from City Hall Park. I mean, from what we call Solidarity Park now, not City Hall Park, the Solidarity Park. We're going to remove them. But we're not going to remove them.
Well, don't back down, Tim. I got to get out of here. But, brother, don't back down.
We are not.
All right. Take care.
99%, and we will win.
Exactly. Later, Tim.
Thank you.
Bye now. Time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for making it all go. Thank you sincerely. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Cold River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and Cold River Wind.